could easily fall from grace, then another would take my place. For the chance to behold your face, and the day of my life is my fragrance of time, as they fall from your golden hand, at the call of the wind's command. Many words you've spoken when there's nothing to say. Far upon the earth, those who don't know the way, to read between the lines, deep between the lines that lead me to you. All that I ask you, show me how to follow you. All over, teach me how to reach you. I can find my own way. Let me keep alive. Let me be the light. The shadow of night is high, the eagle will learn to fly, and the day of his life will find grains of sand as they fall from your open hand. And vanish upon the land. Many words are spoken when there's nothing to say. They fall upon the earth, those who don't know the way. To breathe between the lines, by following the signs I can lead to you. But show me how to follow you and follow you there. Teach me how to reach you, I can find my own way. Let me be the light, let me be the light. And so, with no warning, they'll goodbye. In the dawn of the morning sky, the eagle will rise again.
Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly call. Today is February 5th, 2024. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern Time. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to nationallibertyalliance.org and click on our weekly call for instructions to join us by phone, app, or browser. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions at nationallibertyalliance.org. Please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save our republic. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right side of our website. Okay, we're going to go to our scripture reading, picking up in the Gospel of John. We're in chapter 2. So it's the Gospel of John, chapter 2, read by Alexander Scorby.
Chapter 2. And the third day there was a marriage in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there.
and both Jesus was called and his disciples to the marriage. And when they wanted wine, the mother of Jesus saith unto him, They have no wine. Jesus saith unto her, Woman, what have I to do with thee? Mine hour is not yet come. His mother saith unto the servants, Whatsoever he saith unto you, do it. And there were set there 6 water pots of stone, after the manner of the purifying of the Jews, containing 2 or 3 firkins apiece. Jesus saith unto them, Fill the water pots with water. And they filled them up to the brim. And he saith unto them, Draw out now, and bear unto the governor of the feast. And they bare it. When the ruler of the feast had tasted the water that was made wine, and knew not whence it was, for the servants which drew the water knew, the governor of the feast called the bridegroom, and saith unto him, Every man at the beginning doth set forth good wine, and when men have well drunk, then that which is worse, but thou hast kept the good wine until now. This beginning of miracles did Jesus in Cana of Galilee, and manifested forth his glory, and his disciples believed on him. After this he went down to Capernaum, he and his mother and his brethren and his disciples, and they continued there not many days. And the Jews' Passover was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem, and found in the temple those that sold oxen and sheep and doves and the changers of money sitting. And when he had made a scourge of small cords, he drove them all out of the temple, and the sheep and the oxen, and poured out the changers' money, and overthrew the tables, and said unto them that sold doves, Take these things hence, make not my Father's house an house of merchandise. And his disciples remembered that it was written, The zeal of thine house hath eaten me up. Then answered the Jews and said unto him, What sign showest thou unto us, seeing that thou doest these things? Jesus answered and said unto them, Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Then said the Jews, 46 years was this temple in building, and wilt thou rear it up in 3 days? But he spoke of the temple of his body. When therefore he was risen from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this unto them, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had said. Now when he was in Jerusalem at the Passover, in the feast day, many believed in his name, when they saw the miracles which he did. But Jesus did not commit himself unto them, because he knew all men, and needed not that any should testify of man, for he knew what was in man.
Okay, I don't see Jan here tonight. Maybe he'll come in a little late and they might have some questions that were sent in, but we'll find out soon. We got the queue open. Anybody wants to get in the queue? We do have a couple people in the queue right now. It's a *6 and a 1 if you're coming in on a phone. And if you're coming in on some app or browser, there should be a button to enter the queue. So I guess we'll just go straight into the Q&A tonight. Okay, Marianne, let's see if I can get the mic here. Okay, go ahead, Marianne. You should have the mic.
Hi, John. You may have to turn up your mic again because I know my mic tends to be very low. Can you hear me?
I can hear you well. Can you hear me well?
Yes, I hear you quite well. Thank you. I had a question last week. There was a woman who was on and talking about her husband who's in prison. Did she happen to mention what state she was from?
Ooh, I'm trying to remember if she did.
I thought it was California. I don't know for sure.
Yeah, it doesn't ring a bell for me, but it might have been. I thought she mentioned the state, but I don't remember.
Because she referred to the fact that her husband was being labeled as, was it sexually dangerous?
Yeah, well, he'd been in jail for quite some time. I think she said like 40 years or something like that, and still not out, and he's been up for parole numerous times. But, you know, I don't know the details of what went on with that, and, you know, so we gave her some ideas. You know, the problem that we have right now is that a lot of people are in jail that don't belong there. I mean, we all become obvious of that. Well, a lot of us here have known this for quite some time, but, you know, it's getting out to the general public, and they're becoming aware of that. I believe there's over 1,000 people arrested at this point, probably more to come, from out in, on January 6th, so that's not stopping. But the big problem is that we don't have courts of record, and really everyone that has been convicted of any kind of a crime for quite some time now, at least going back to many years anyway, you know, once we bring things back to order and open up our courts of justice again, they have a right to a new court, a new hearing, a new trial. a lot of people in county jails that don't belong there at all. Anybody who had been put in jail by a town court or a village court, and even most city courts, they're in there unlawfully. They don't have the authority. They didn't get them due process. Anybody that was tried with a jury less than six people or less than 12 people also have not gotten a fair trial. And because almost, well, just about every jury is tainted, just in the fact that they hold things back, they don't, you know, give them the understanding of their authority and their power and what common law is all about as far as their decision making, then again, you know, they haven't been tried with a proper jury. It's been illegal trials. Another thing is when judges put forward a sentencing that they're working off of legislative, you know, information in order to decide what the penalty would be, is again another violation of law. It's the people to decide with an eye on restitution. So there are so many problems, and we're going to be quite busy, I think, after we get through devolution, to deal with all the problems of all the people that are in jail. So it's a major problem, and something that's going to have to be dealt with sooner or later. And I think once we take back our federal courts, we can then take back all of our lower courts. But, you know, again, this woman has a good point to some things. And but again, I don't judge the case. I don't know too much about it or anything.
Well, the reason why I'm asking this, because when I was living in Illinois, there was a 725 ILCS, was it 205 and 725 ILCS, 745, 207. And what that was if somebody were sexually, when they were first arrested, before they were, when they were tried, they were designated like if they were sexually violent, like if the case was sexually violent, it would be designated sexually violent in the court hearing. So they would be considered sexually, like labeled sexually violent. And then what they would do is, like, once they were in prison, then they would bring their case before the court again, before another court, and have them labeled sexually dangerous. So if they were then, it was one way or the other, like, I think if it was a violent crime, it was violent. And then if they were not, and then there was considered to be, like, they were now sexually dangerous, they would then lose all of their rights. They would lose all their civil, like, all, like, they would become basically like a child ward of the warden of the IDOC. And then what they would do, they would force them into psychiatric treatment. And there were cases out there where there were men who were trying to fight this. And because of the $400 charge for the court, certainly they would try to have the impaparis to have it covered so that they can have their case tried. It would usually be denied. So they were denied their civil liberty, their rights completely, like becoming children, and they became wards, and they were forced into psychiatric treatment. If they tried to fight it, then they were usually denied any court access. It's crazy. There are cases out there. You can find them. I found one. I talked to my husband about it because he was working in the IDOC at Stateville Prison. So I really couldn't communicate because he was working in the prison. I couldn't really do anything because it would mess with his status as a volunteer working in the prison. So I never followed up on it. But they're out there, and I was thinking if it's that same kind of, because it sounds like they're moving towards that with this man out in California. Like that's what it sounds like, the same kind of kind of set up, basically it's a setup. And then what they do, because the sexual deviance, usually because they've been sexually abused when they were younger, and that's what causes usually leads to a lot of these issues, sexual violence and everything, and transvestite and all this stuff, they're usually easier to manipulate and to mind control. So they basically turn them into, like, army, military. Are you there?
Yeah, we're still here.
Yeah, so they're basically, you know, I look at it, I look at Illinois, and it looks like they're building an army, you know, in the prison. You know what I mean? Like mind control.
Well, yeah, you look, our entire judicial system is in serious trouble. Again, you know, we just the due process, lack of due process, people in prison that shouldn't be there, people that are in prison that should be there, and yet they've been tried illegally. They deserve, all people deserve another hearing, another case, and it needs to be decided by the people. And again, you know, they throw everybody in prison. Everything's a jail sentence, which is not the way common law is. Common law does everything it can to move beyond the jail problem, you know, the jail sentence, and really focus in on the restitution. Of course, when you have certain crimes, when individuals can't control themselves, maybe they're violent or whatever the case may be, then prison would be the right thing to do. I think one of the major problems, and again, in the prisons are like, they deal with them to some degree, they're like animals. And, you know, a lot of people, especially patriotic people that are in jail, you know, they put up solitary confinement, and it's literally almost torture. And I did that with a lot of people anyway, and I think it's, in my opinion, that's cruel and unusual punishment, solitary confinement. You know, there are just so many problems. So there's no chance of healing. There's no chance of the individuals really being brought back into society when they get out of jail, you know, unless they're really aged at that time. You know, they come back out in the streets and nothing has changed, and maybe there's a lot of anger and so on and so forth. Another thing they do is to allow people to know what an individual is in jail for. And some situations, you know, they may get injured by the other, or even killed by the other inmates because of their ideas or thoughts of whatever the case may be. I mean, there's so many problems, just so many problems. I've visited friends many, many years ago in Rikers Island and in other prisons also. Going into those prisons and talking with people and then I got to know one of the officers within the prison, one of the correctional officers. And he was dating a girl that I had known, and I got to know him. And this guy was sick. I mean, and the way they talk about the things they do and what's going on in the prisons, it's really sickening. So our whole system is rotted from the core, and something needs to be done. many of the crimes are not necessarily violent or sexual in nature, and doesn't necessarily deserve a jail sentence. And restitution is really the best remedy because, you know, common law is looking not only to restore the injured party, but also to restore the individual who injured that person. So there is, a proper system under common law will bring people back together and change minds and hearts. But what we have right now, and I understand, In relationship to the population of the United States and the relationship of any other country, that we have more people in prison than any other country. And that's pretty sad for a common law nation, very sad, especially a natural law common law nation. Back to you, Marianne.
Okay. Well, thank you for that. And also, on another topic, I sent to Jan an amicus brief that was signed by over 3,000 people, and on behalf of President Trump in his case this coming Thursday. And I wanted to mention something to you that I found very interesting. The Supreme Court actually approved for the Secretary of State of Colorado, for the case, to be allowed to speak for 10 minutes to the case on behalf of the case, right, against President Trump. And they didn't take it away from the 30, because they're allotted, the plaintiff and defendant are each allotted 30 minutes. So what they did was they actually added 10 minutes. So now they have 40 minutes, 10 minutes for the Secretary of State to speak, to defend their, you know, their case, and then also then for the defendant to have 30 minutes. So our amicus is on behalf of President Trump, and the lead filer, Terpsichore Maris, she filed now for us to be able to have our case argued, because our amicus is the only one that brings up the that argues on behalf of the 9th, 10th, as well as the 14th Amendment, because all the other parties in the case, like everybody's arguing, and everybody else's brief is about the 14th Amendment, whereas we're the only ones arguing in support of President Trump and support of defending our 9th and the 10th Amendment. So, like going up to Colorado because they're going beyond their jurisdiction as a state. I just thought you'd find that really interesting. I found it very interesting because I think it may have. I can't believe the leniency that, like, SCOTUS is relaxing their rules, and it made me think of the Rules Act, the 1934 Rules Act, and it made me think of the case that you brought up against them as well, like that you filed. So I think it's made a difference.
Well, I think what's really making the difference is the liberation of the United States Supreme Court, particularly with the latest new individuals that were put up there, of course, by Trump, and a few that were already on board up there. And because I think a lot of these things and a lot of these decisions that the United States Supreme Court has been making over the past couple of years would have been done a long time ago, as long as there was a majority, at least. I hate to use conservative or Republican. We shouldn't be using that at all. But unfortunately, you know, everybody thinks in those terms. And, you know, a judge is not supposed to have any bias. I mean, if they have bias, they shouldn't be there. I mean, if you look at the caliber of the judges that are being that have been approved over the past couple of years through Congress going up, that's been sent up there by the Biden administration, they're literally morons. They have no clue. They don't even know what the Bill of Rights is. They couldn't even quote certain parts of the Bill of Rights. They didn't understand some major cases or wasn't even aware. I know there was one person that was sent up there and they never even heard a real case at all. They were just making administrative decisions, and this particular one was making it on the Labor Department decisions, and yet you have this judge that's been approved. You know, and the other thing, of course, is the major problem is the fact that these judges think that they can try individuals. They cannot try individuals. They can only try, the agencies or the individuals working within those agencies, agents. But even with that, if it becomes a criminal case, then it now goes to the people. But as far as the people are concerned, no judge can judge people, and that happens all day long. And then you get plead of guilties, and then they make the decision, and they give them a penalty, and they coerce them to plead guilty by frightening them and say, hey, we're going for 20 years. You're going to be in jail for 20 years, but look, plead guilty, we'll give you 3. You know, things like that. All that is unlawful. That is not common law. That is not permitted. That is not due process. That is not the people deciding, because the people have the final decision on that. And yet they've never been given the option to do that. So, again, everyone that's in jail really shouldn't be there, guilty or not. So, all right, anything else?
No, I'm still doing research on the economic development stuff, World Economic Forum and UN, and I'm...
Well, bear in mind, we've done Amicus Curiae also before, and, you know, they don't care about anything. They're not going to take anything to heart. The United States Supreme Court might, but certainly none of the judges that are deciding these cases concerning President Trump, they don't care.
Well, I think in this case, Trump is going to win on Thursday.
Well, he's going to win in the end anyway. He's not going to be held convicted of anything. He didn't break any laws. I mean, anybody looking at the cases and looking at what's going on and understanding, you know, it's all a setup to try to get rid of him because he's a danger to them. You know, he's trying to destroy democracy. And he actually, well, he doesn't realize it, but he actually is trying to destroy democracy. At least I think some of the people behind him should know that, and at least you would hope that the United States Supreme Court should know that. And we will make it clear that democracy is not what we are. And, you know, they keep complaining because they know that if we come to realize that we're a republic and not a democracy, it's a whole new ballgame then. And they know that. Democracy is the only way they could have taken down this country. The purpose of democracies is just the first step to lead a country or a nation into an oligarchy. And we've been in an oligarchy for quite some time now, until Trump became president. Probably the last real president, free president we had was Kennedy. They took him out. I think Reagan tried, but he learned real quick. There wasn't much he could do. But Trump was able to accomplish the goal, and he's going to finish the job, there's no doubt in my mind. So that's where we're at.
Lord willing, we'll be able to, yes. There's definitely been from what I'm gathering, there's been a World Economic Forum, UN takeover of our country. And, I mean, there are peacekeepers on the north in Canada, you know, on a northern border. Kind of scary.
The UN is a tool also. It's a tool of the elite, but go ahead.
Oh, yeah, it's been totally everything. Everything's been weaponized, everything. And everything's to keep Trump out.
Mm-hmm.
They really would love to just have us be back in our shells and our false sense of security, living in our false sense of security. And we can't go back.
Right. I don't know if people really realize this. I think the people that have been involved for a long time realize this, but... If Trump didn't get into office, we'd all be in shackles by now or sent to the gallows because their plan was to take us all out in slavery. I mean, they're doing everything they can to destroy us, you know, and poison has been put into our food system going all the way back even into the 50s and the 60s. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of things that have been put in food. Look, they made us all addicted to sugar. They put sugar in everything. Carbohydrates, you know, they made us addicted to that. It's in the cereals. High fructose corn syrup, and so many other things. But those are the biggies that have been released kind of early and been moving through the system. And that's why diabetes is so high. Obesity is high. Heart problems. I mean, you get a lot of weight on the belly, particularly. It causes a fatty liver and you have problems with the liver and many, many other things. It just goes on and on. They get rid of, they destroyed vitamin C. Nobody really gets real vitamin C. You have to hunt it out to get it. You know, if you're taking any kind of a vitamin, it's not a natural vitamin C. And if you get a rose hips, for instance, I looked at that and I was taking rose hips. But then I looked at the back to see only 2% of it is rose hips. And that's not very much when you're going for vitamin C. They tried to make vitamin C illegal. They had a tough time with that. They pasteurize orange juice or anything that might have vitamin C in it. Once you raise the temperature to 105 or 106, something like that, something above that maybe 110, somewhere around there. That's pasteurizing. Once you do that, you've destroyed the vitamin D in milk. You've destroyed the vitamin C in orange juice. They've outlawed vitamin B17, which is also referred to as laetrile, which is another form of it, but it's still a type of a vitamin 17, and that's a cure for most cancers. It prevents cancers and it cures cancers. And you can't buy that in the United States, which is kind of strange because I do buy some. And I buy it, it's been a while since I bought any, but I have bought from a company out in California, and then they ship from Mexico. Somehow that works out to be legal somehow. I don't know, but in any event, there is a way to get it. So they've done everything they can. They've poisoned us and really addicted us to a lot of stuff that we shouldn't be eating. Processed foods are all poisonous in the sense that it's destructive to our bodies. Our soil has been depleted of minerals, so we don't get the richness or even the enough vitamins from that. Tastes bland, and it goes on and on and on. And my knowledge of this is very bare minimal. You know, I don't have a high knowledge of these things, but just the basics. You know? Mm-hmm. But it's a mess. We're in trouble, and we need a lot of work. And then we have to help people to break their habits. And you know, sugar habit is really hard.
Thank you.
A few other people in the queue. Anybody else wants to get into the queue? Star 6 and 1 if you're on a phone. If you got an app, there should be a button there to get into the queue. All right, are we done?
Yes, thank you.
Okay. Anthony, West Virginia, you got the mic. Go right ahead. Anthony from West Virginia. The mic should be open.
There I am. Mic's on. I turned my mic off just in case I'm making noise that might get in the way if my mic's on inappropriately. Can you hear me all right now?
We can hear you all right. I try to do the same thing. Go right ahead.
Okay. Yeah. Well, did you guys, anybody get a phone call from me? I started the robocall process just to introduce people to the system. Did you get a phone call, a voicemail message, or anything?
No, I haven't. No.
Anybody else?
Well,
Everybody
else is muted. But if anybody else did get a call, and they'd like to share that, they can hit *6 and 1 and or come into the queue through the an app.
Okay.
And let us know.
Yeah, it was a phone call. I made a phone call. I made an outgoing message, and then I put it through this system called Dial My Number or something like that, mm-hmm. and just to test to see how it was going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just I just was hoping that people would get their phone call and then be able to tell me a little bit about how that experience was and if it was a bother or if it's something that we might be able to use. I plan on using it to help contact all these people in my 4 states and in West Virginia so that I can at least communicate with them without having to dial their number all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a message, and they pick up the phone and the message goes out.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't pick up the phone, it should go to their voicemail.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so maybe you check your voicemail. You might have missed a call.
Well, I don't have voicemail, so you either get me.
Okay. All right. Then I never get you anyway, John.
Well, I always check my numbers and try to call back, but, you know, sometimes it gets so busy I can't. So.
Yeah. That's okay. Maybe somebody else got the call. Maybe somebody will bring it up tonight. Who knows?
Did you get the list from us, or did you get the list?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm using the District 7. I'm using the District 7 list. But actually, for this call, it was just a test call. I only contacted, I don't know, maybe 13 people or so, maybe 25 people. I'm not sure. It was just a test. So I was trying to contact all the top people, like, you and Gerard and Jan and Ed. And then some other people I just had their numbers handy and I put them on there.
Mm-hmm. Eric, did you get anything? Eric might have been on that.
No, I didn't get anything.
Okay.
Maybe you did something wrong. You know what? Next time you do it, add your own phone number, or if you have a second number.
I did, as a matter of fact. Did I get a... I gotta check my other phone. Let me check my other phone. You guys talk about something else. Anyway, that's about all I have today. Everything is... I went to a planning commission meeting. Got good news in our county. I mean, our planning commission, they're good people. So I'm just looking forward to working with these people. What the guy that was the head of the, you know, whatever his... What, the chairman or whatever... And he said, well, I was a Boy Scout, you know, and now I'm doing this, and I grew up with so-and-so, and he was that, and now he's here. So these people have been around this community for a long time, and they're patriots, unless they know how to snow people really, really well, you know. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm around a bunch of patriots here in Princeton. So that's about it.
Okay. Appreciate it.
Always good to talk to you, John.
The same. Thank you.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
I'll reach the next person. But again, if anybody wants to get into the queue, we only have two people left in the queue. If anybody's got anything, they want to question, comment, maybe some questions about the website or starting a committee of safety or education that we put up there. Or we've got a lot of stuff up online. Maybe there's a lot of questions for that. So, again, *601 if you're on a phone, and... hit that enter the queue, whatever it is. There must be a button somewhere that says enter the queue once the queue is open. And it is open. So, okay, let's take our next person. It is 502 area code. What's your first name and your state?
Hey, this is Josh here in Kentucky.
Josh from Kentucky. Hey, hey Josh.
I'm good. And yourself?
Good, thank you.
We'll try to get to the point. So I am in the process of filing a removal for cause in a district court, well, filing it in a federal district court, and then serving it, of course, to the state, the AG. And so I'm in the middle of doing that. I've got most everything wrote up. So there's a particular question. Do I have to include in the packet that I serve a summons?
Yes.
Or does that, okay. And so I know, you know, how some documents, like for example, you know, say the notice of removal, can that act as a summons as well if you word it correctly, or is that generally completely separate?
Well, you know, again, you would put a summons on top of that, I would think. You know, if you're removing for cause, I mean, I would put a summons on it. And I'm not sure that I was ever taught that, but that would be the way to go, I would think. They play a game a lot, you know. If you don't put that summons in there, then they claim they didn't get it and they ignore it, and it goes on in the court system. They play along with all that silliness. I mean, you know, you know, again, when you're moving for cause, what cause are you going for? What's the cause?
So you said what's the court or what's the cause?
Yeah, you're gonna move to federal court from what, from state court? What is it, a county court or a state court or what kind of court?
Federal.
But, well, what kind of court are you in right now?
That's the district, state court. Yeah, district state court. It started out as a traffic ticket, and I didn't want to just go and win on the facts. And so they don't have jurisdiction, and we don't have to get into all that because that's probably
Yeah, they don't have personam jurisdiction over you because it's a
court. Yeah. And I told them that I did show up in court. You know, I showed up on the Zoom meeting and said, I object. And she said, well, that's okay. I said, I object because you don't have jurisdiction. And she said, and she goes, oh, that's okay. I'll put a plea in for you. And I said, I objected to that, so you can't do that. against the law. And so she ignored me, of course, and did that. And then we had, went through a hearing, and second and third hearing. Say that again.
That's a sad cause. They can't make the decision for you to put in a, you know, a guilty or not guilty plea. They can't put a plea in for you. You know,
yeah.
You got to be careful. I mean, the question to the judge would be, are you my lawyer? You know, because...
Right. Oh, yeah.
You got to be careful because people could be dangerous, you know, because they got the gun, so to speak.
That's right. They do. And I acknowledge that, you know. When I went in, I said, hey, I'm here on special appearance. I object to all of this. I'm just here observing. But you did call my name, and I have a right to defend myself, so I can't fully participate in your court. But if I am here observing this. And so she started asking me questions. I said, well, you know, we don't really have to do this. But essentially, if you're asking me as just a person, an actual person, then I can tell you what my thoughts are, and I can say that you don't have personal jurisdiction. And I basically, you know, said a couple of things of that nature. And she said, well, I don't understand what you're saying, and we need to do a Feretta hearing and see if you're competent. And I laughed and said, well, you can do whatever you want. This is, I like I said, I'm not here participating in this. This is, I'm here observing. And so they had a Feretta hearing, and I did show up, and I said, again, I'm here on special appearance. I'm just observing. And
did you bring up the issue that it was an equity case, and that?
Well, I did, but I did ask. I asked several questions, key questions. You know, what constitutional authority, or is the plaintiff, is the prosecutor acting, is the state acting against me, and what jurisdiction is he claiming to have, and what kind to the judge, what kind of court is this? Is this a civil court, criminal court? Are you, how are you proceeding? What set of rules or laws? And she wouldn't say. She absolutely.
It doesn't sound like you're in a state court, because you would think the state judges would understand that. As a matter of fact, here in New York, anyway, they will not hear those kind of cases. That these cases, you know, that are traffic violations. Will be heard by, you know, city courts, town courts, village courts, but never state courts. I've never heard of
that. Yeah, it just says a district court, but it is a court under the Commonwealth of Kentucky.
Well,
so they'll tell you they blended all this together. They'll tell you that.
Yeah, they unified they unified the courts here in New York. I know that they did that,
mm-hmm.
But it still doesn't matter anyway. But yeah, it's a tricky thing with the calling it a district court. It's a very interesting name, and I would quiz them more on that. You know, I don't know. You should say, I don't understand what even kind of court this is. Is this?
I did. I made that claim.
What, you know, yeah. I mean, here in New York, we call, and I think all states should do it this way. We call the court that has the authority, we call it the Supreme Court. So every county has a Supreme Court, okay? And, of course, you can appeal up the line, but each court is called a Supreme Court. And these Supreme Courts will not hear a traffic violation or anything, commercial activity or any of those things. But I do know that some states, you know, I guess they do. So
it's really weird. The answer doesn't make any sense, and it doesn't make sense to them, and that's why they can't explain it. And asking some of those questions, I said, okay, well, here again, you're asking me questions, so I have a right to defend myself and answer, but I am not. I made it very clear every time. I am not participating in your court. This is your court, and I said, so I'm just observing, but along with your questions, Your Honor, I'm confused because I don't understand what you guys are doing. Can you again? Do you mind? I know you're trying to check my competency here, and I'm not going to participate. But can you at least tell me how you're proceeding, and are you going to do under civil Kentucky procedure law, civil law? Are you going to do criminal? And all I think she would do is hold up the traffic citation. She held it up, and that's it. All she would do. And I said, okay, well, in that case, I can assume then that you're holding that uniform traffic citation up, that you are under the UCC, the Uniform Commercial Code. And I said, so you're looking for a contract, and the plaintiff has to have a contract, and we have no contract. And I said, and if he thinks he has a contract, it's probably that driver's license, right? And I turned and looked to him, and he kind of smiled, and I said, well, if you look at your contract, it shows that I signed it under duress, which under contract law basically voids that unless there's a, you know, unless I'm doing something fraudulent in the first place.
Even with that, still, you go back to the there's no meeting of the minds. No, any contract that
right.
the minds,
sure.
no contract at all, yeah. no matter what they have, even with signatures, anything, there's got to be a meeting of the minds. But are you taking our course?
I was trying to. I started to, actually. I've got the books. I've got Government by Consent, and I've got Court Access and Common Law, and I've read through them. And so...
Well, in there, in the course, and I might have it in the book, too, but, you know, the course is updated, and all the paperwork that I do, I try to update things as I go along, so things will change. But I did put together a challenge of jurisdiction paper. And is that what you did? Did you challenge a jurisdiction on paper?
Yeah, I did. When I was there that day, I basically said, look, I don't want to be here. And she goes, what do you want to do? I said, well, I want to go home. I don't want to be here. This has nothing to do with me. I said, so she says, well, why don't you just pay, the plaintiff said, why don't you just pay the ticket? And I said, that's not the matter here. The matter is you don't have jurisdiction. And until you get jurisdiction, blah, blah. She goes, okay, well, I don't understand why you keep saying that. And I said, okay, look, let me just make it really simple. You got to have a contract. The state has to have a contract. And through that, that's what gives you jurisdiction. You don't have jurisdiction because he didn't have a contract. He has no legal standing to be here to making the claim. So where are we at? We're nowhere. So I said, and if you look at that supposed contract, the driver's license, I signed it under duress, and then I also put UCC 1-308 on there, which means that's the opt-out code. It means I'm not participating. She shut me down so fast. When I said that, I literally, she almost knocked papers off her desk. I kid you not. And she shuffled and kicked around and looked around and patted her desk and said, I don't have anything in writing. Whoa, stop, stop. And I said, oh, that's okay, Your Honor. If you would like an affidavit in writing, I'll give you an affidavit or an affirmation. She goes, yes, I'll take that. And I said, okay. I said, well, I can have it to you in like, I don't know what, 2 weeks? She goes, oh, no. No, you can, 60 days. You have 60 days. And I said, no, I don't need 60 days. I'll get to you in 2 weeks. She goes, no, how about 30 days? She was trying to buy herself time. I said, okay, I'll take 30 days. 30 days is good. We'll do that. I'll file this for the clerk and you'll have my affidavit and you'll have everything in there. Well, I did that affidavit and I got a response. And the prosecutor responded back with absolute, and this is part of the reason I'm moving it to federal court, because it's not just, my reasons, the cause. It is, you know, there's four or five causes that I've got listed.
Right, and there's you don't argue the case in federal court.
Right.
You don't even bring it up.
Right.
You're talking about the constitutional violations.
Right. So here's my question, really. Here's really where I'm getting at. So I've got removal for cause, and I've got four or five, but they're, you know, and I'm using your removal for cause out of your book here, basically. You know, it's a version of yours, right? and I've just modified it. And so I've got, defendant has no agreement with the plaintiff, and after the plaintiff notified the court that he lived and traveled at natural common law, and he, you know, so then I give my little bit of short blurb about no jurisdiction, basically. But the other is the defendant not being able to prove a claim or fiduciary authority or contract over plaintiff necessary for a lawful seizure, blah, blah, blah. And then the third one, defendant violated the plaintiff's constitutional protected rights by excessive judicial authority when the initial judge, who is not named, falsely, because this is a different judge. The judge actually moved this to another judge, and I didn't realize that, but I found that out. But so the judge falsely entered a plea of not guilty, which plaintiff objected to, and the judge, and this current judge proceeded. And I let that judge know, and she continued to proceed. So that's one. That's another. And then the other one is really one I want you to address. And this is for the prosecutor's response to the plaintiff. To me, I'm the plaintiff here, of course, in the federal court. The prosecutor's response to me, to the motion, was very misleading. And I kid you not, every single point that he made, that I made, he went through. And so he said to the court, in his response, he said, I was arguing subject matter jurisdiction. Never once did I mention subject matter jurisdiction. So that right there, then he says, so he's arguing subject matter jurisdiction. Your Honor, look, that doesn't have any, that, and he goes on and gives us a little spiel. And then he goes to the next thing. Then he calls me a sovereign citizen.
A sovereign citizen?
Yeah, he calls me a sovereign. So, of course, you know, I don't like that, of course, because if you go to the FBI's website, that's a terrorist, and or someone like a terrorist. Either way, it's an association which puts me in harm's way. It's the way I see it. You know, I don't like somebody kicking in my door at 12 o'clock at night.
That puts you in jeopardy. He threatened you in that sense.
Absolutely. And so he's misleading the court is another. That's the biggest thing, really. And then, of course, so I said, you know, this is libel and slander. He's put me in jeopardy on this terrorist watch list. And the judge did not receive the plaintiff's. So then there's all these little games.
Those issues you can't take into the federal court. Remember that, because that's going to be problematic. We'll throw it right out. Something that they have to decide outside of their jurisdictional authorities, and they're going to throw the whole case right out. One sentence, and
okay.
But that doesn't mean you can't go to them in a state court, okay,
right.
Later, because you got a lawsuit against that person.
Yeah, and so that was one of the ones I wanted to put in here, but I was questioning whether to put that cause in here, because I knew it really didn't belong in federal jurisdiction, except...
What you want to do, though, is that could be bringing it back into the jurisdiction. Yeah, that's best just to deal with outside at a later date and sue, in a state court. You don't want to bring that up.
So you don't want to do that? Okay. I mean, I mean, it is a civil, I guess, I mean, okay, anyway. Yeah, no, I agree. That's why I'm bringing it up.
You don't want to counter-sue in that court, because you don't want to sue in that court because it's not a court of record. And being that's not a court of record, they can't give you due process. And because you denied them because they don't have personam jurisdiction, I don't know if you brought up the court of record part, but if you did, or even if you didn't, it's still a denial of due process. So again, that brings you right back again to another constitutional violation. You know, so it's
I did bring up the court of record. Absolutely. I mean, it's all in my. I got a 10-page affidavit. Then I responded to his response with a 7-page affidavit explaining, correcting his response and calling him out, basically saying, you totally misled the court on all these points. And why did you do that? And so the judge, of course, obviously, they know each other, right? And so but here's the other issue that I want to...
Let me ask another question. Now, you're in Kentucky. Did you sit around and listen to other cases before you, and maybe even after?
Oh gosh, as soon as they knew I was coming, evidently, because when I denied them the judge jurisdiction, and just resumed, and she gave me the place. They put me on a list or something, because when I showed up, they moved my docket. They had my docket. They called it. My last name is Robinson, so it's R. Well, they moved it, and then they moved it, and then they moved it, and they kept moving it until I was the last person sitting in that courtroom, and they did it every single time.
Yeah, they don't want anyone to
get the same thing. Yeah, I know. So the other issue, the other cause here, and I don't know if this can be brought up in the federal. It probably not, because it's really, but then again, I don't know. I might be able to. So they're denying me due process, right? That's the real cause, right? They're denying me due process.
Also hijacking you to jurisdictions unknown.
Unknown, right.
So yep. On the jurisdiction, I hijacked into it. I challenged it. You didn't answer it. Now you've hijacked me into this system. It's not a court of record. There's no power, no authority.
So this one is a little tricky, maybe. But if you know the Constitution of Kentucky, it is very, very clear. I love it, actually. And it says in the Bill of Rights, Section 1, that I have a right to safety and happiness and all that. Mm-hmm. And in Section 2, this is something very unique. It says, at Section 2, absolute and arbitrary power denied. Absolute and arbitrary power over the lives, liberty, and property of free men exists nowhere in a republic. Not even in the largest majority. So I've taken that and I put it in here and I said, the defendants are violating the plaintiff's right to due process under the principles of a republic form of government as clarified in Section 2 of the Bill of Rights in this Kentucky Constitution, wherein it states, and then I state that, and then I say, and here's the key, and I say, the jury procedures used in some of the criminal and civil courts in the state are in direct conflict with Section 2, wherein a trial by jury is offered, but a majority decision rules. Clearly, as it says, not even in the largest majority can rights be removed or trespassed by absolute or arbitrary power. The 100% consensus of a jury is demanded by law where the natural rights of the people are involved. And I say this is an ancient mode. It says this in the Constitution, in the Kentucky Constitution. It says in Section 7, it says this is an ancient mode of trial by jury and is held, or it is to be held sacred, as mentioned in Section 7 of the Bill of Rights.
Yeah, I wouldn't get too deep in that, though. I mean, yeah, you can use something, what you're talking about, but I keep it very, very shallow. I wouldn't get too deep in it because, again, you want to stick to the points. Now, when you use the Kentucky Constitution and you have the Bill of Rights, the principles are there. Also, the same principles are in the federal case, so you want to kind of make the attachment and let that be the lead. And then you can, of course, bring in the Kentucky Constitution, and especially when you're talking about the Bill of Rights, which is protective of unalienable rights.
Reverse it, perhaps.
You want to keep it really simple when you go into the court, and that's in all cases. You know, again, you know, you tell your case, and which you don't have to necessarily get too involved, but you got to have an affidavit. So, your affidavit lays out all the facts. Okay, and you may list out to certain facts in your papers, depending on the type of case you're going into or you're being drawn into the court. That's a different story, of course. But you want to keep everything very, very minimum. And when you make certain statements that is kind of long-winded to really lay out and show the court that you're right, you do that in memorandum and you attach memorandums. But when you go in, if you got a case and if you can do your case in 3 or 4 or 5 pages, or even less if possible. I mean, going into federal court, you should be able to do it very, very minimum, a couple of pages. And anything you'd want to really get deep down into. Again, you want to have your affidavit. Or you can do, because it's a federal case and it's a very simple case and it's all violations of your unalienable rights, you could do a make your paper, the original paper, your complaint. You can make that a verified complaint or a verified action. I use the word action. I don't like the word complaint. So a verified action, I like to say action at law. So a verified action at law, and that means it becomes an affidavit. You get it notarized at the bottom, and then you can put the facts in there. But again, that's only if there's a minimum. And in the case that you're doing, it should be minimum anyway. So I would do it in one and make that the affidavit and everything. Now, but generally speaking, if you go into court and you have a situation where there's a lot to the story, you want to put it mostly in the affidavit, attach it, and you put it as per, you know, the attached affidavit of your name or one of the people of your state in this court of record. Then you're suing, countersuing, whatever the case may be. But then you do lay out certain facts because you got to lay out the facts to support each cause. But again, this is not the type of case that you're doing because yours is simple. It's just constitutional violations. It's a very simple case. And you should win it. Not to say that you're going to win it, but you should win it. And because the federal courts are really there to champion your constitution, your unalienable rights protected by the Constitution. That's what they're there for. And, of course, to hear equity cases. You know, the United States Supreme Court, for instance, hears cases that they don't have the power or the authority to hear. Now, when they overturned, for instance, Roe versus Wade, they didn't have the authority to hear that case at all. Because that had nothing to do with equity, right? And there's a lot of things that they hear and listen to because they don't have the power or the authority to hear it. But they make these decisions. You know, when they took the Bible out of the school, I mean, we're going to be doing a case concerning that when we go into the federal judiciary, probably by the end of the year. We're going after the federal judiciary, and it'll be an indictment on it. As a matter of fact, we might very well do an indictment on the federal judiciary as a whole. Hopefully we'll hit critical mass because then it'll be really more powerful to have enough people coming to our, call for a grand jury, and where we can possibly get thousands of people, which would be really nice, or at least many hundreds. Usually we don't get that many. We'll get under 100, maybe, depending. I mean, you know, in the past, we used to have a lot more people coming to our call, and people fall away, unfortunately. They don't have the endurance for some reason. I just don't know what it is. But in any event, when we do, pull a grand jury together, we usually get quite a few people. It could be 30 or 40, 50 or 80 or 100 people. We've had quite a few in the past, maybe close to 100. But to be able to get a large response would be really powerful. Now, we don't have to tell the number, and we didn't necessarily make note of the number, so it really doesn't matter. I mean, we pull in, 24, 25 people, and we're good. So, but again, this the whole judicial system is has to be revamped. It's got to be taken apart and put back together as under the common law.
What do you think, John? What do you think the probability is of the federal courts siding on my side, realistically?
Well, you're going up against the status quo on one end, but you're not really going up against the status quo, and if they go to court and you have a hearing and they anger the judge, you got a real good chance, of course, for that. If the judge just rules according to the status quo when he has no choice, the gun is to the head, and he has to do it, then you're not going to get there. But in very rare cases, you can. In this case here, it's not something that goes into the federal court often to begin with. Very few people will take a traffic court case into the federal court. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, you're not even talking about a traffic court. They don't even know it's about a traffic case. They have no clue what it's about. All they know is what you're saying and you're proving, and they can't. And they may deny it, but they can't prove the opposite, that they do have any authority or jurisdiction over you. And with that instead, I think the judges will feel a lot more comfortable to just do the right thing. sometimes even just for the purpose of doing the right thing, maybe, or looking like they're doing the right thing, finally they're going to rule for the people kind of thing. You know, I think you have a good chance, a good shot at it.
Okay. In my affidavit, should I bring up the nature of this, or the purpose that brought us there? Should I bring up that I was pulled over and cited?
No, you don't talk. You don't bring nothing up about anything but the violations. A,
just
you're in
the
a
violations.
A, they didn't have jurisdiction over you, personam jurisdiction. And all the other violations, but you have to just list those out, but you don't get into any conversation of that at all.
Will they not? Will the state not walk in there and do that?
That federal court should not even know what that case is about. They shouldn't have a clue. All they know is you're challenging the jurisdiction. They don't have it, and they can't prove that they do, so you should win, generally speaking, you should win.
Yeah.
So just keep it short and sweet, you know. We have in our, I don't know if I have it in the book, again, you know, the court case, the course is put together a little different than the book. It's just, you know, the book was put together one way, and then when I put the course together, I put it with a different structure because I had to teach it and I had to start from the minimum thing going up, and we had to add a lot of things in there, and we got in a lot of common law stuff in there, and we looked at rules and the rules of common law and that kind of thing. But I got a lot of updated papers in that court, in that case. We have an IRS case, which I think is very powerful, and we have a traffic case in there, which is the latest update and the most powerful that I've written to date anyway. You know, well, every time you write papers, you get better at it, you know. But those are a couple of cases, and then, you know, even some arguments back and forth, which is really, you know, helpful. But your case is a simple case in the sense it should be done in one hearing. You come in, you got your papers, you give them your papers, you go in there and you make your points, you made your points, you have your notes, and then you get your argument going, which they should have done on paper already. And you already know some of the things that they're going to make the claim, so you should be ready to be able to defend those things. So,
should I bring up, I mentioned to you that, but can I make one of the causes? It seems like there's some redundancy, and I'm a little worried about that because...
Stay away from redundancy. Don't get redundant.
Yeah.
Keep it simple. Just the facts, focus in and get out. Don't bring anything up that shouldn't be brought up. Again, you're looking at constitutional issues only.
And that, you think that if I do... make that one of the causes is that they denied me due process under the principles of a republic, and then maybe make a statement about getting this from the Republic of Kentucky?
Well,
they're violating their own constitution? I don't know. I just seems like that makes sense.
You want to go to the Constitution for this, the U.S. Constitution, and you want to refer to the fact that you didn't get your due process under the Fifth Amendment, and they were not a court of record as being required under the Seventh Amendment. Those are the two major ones. And again, this.
Well, I did request on the record, and I did request verbally and in my affidavit to them, I did request very clearly that. And I even opened a court of record, actually, in my affidavit,
mm-hmm.
or my move, my show call.
Well, you really didn't have to do that. Just the fact that you're on the special appearance, number one.
Yeah.
So you're not participating, but you're just defending and making the point you should be out of it because they don't have jurisdiction. So that's again, look, you got to keep things simple. You bring an iota of anything outside the Constitution into that federal court, it's going to be cast out. The judge doesn't want to go to hear it.
Okay, very good.
They should not be able to bring it up either. They might try to bring it up in the court thing that they'll get the judge to say, you know, rule because it is a traffic violation or whatever the case may be. And you should object to that. That has nothing to do with this case. We're not talking about that. This is a whole new case. You violated my unalienable rights. You've injured me.
Yeah.
And you got to make sure in your wherefore clause that you have that you want that case needs to cease and desist. And then, of course, yeah. You want to face whatever restitution you think is necessary. I would go with real money, Morgan Silver dollars. Yeah. Make it very clear.
I did. I used your format there. I just put in exactly what I think the prosecutor should pay and what the judge should pay, and then what the general attorney should do. Not really pay, but I want them to mend the records on the state and county level. The district attorney and the AG and the secretary to put it on the record that I am not a United States citizen of the 14th Amendment in any way. I am a natural man and I travel at the Commonwealth.
You should never, ever, ever get into that conversation. And if they bring it up, again, when they use the word sovereign citizen, my response would be, I am sovereign. The Constitution is clear. We, the people, ordained and established this Constitution to control you people. And we've given you your marching orders. We've given you your powers. We've given you authorities. And you don't have you've taken more authority than we've given. So we're taking it back. We're saying no. So I am a sovereign person. Am I a citizen of the United States? Absolutely, I'm a citizen of the United States. A citizen.
I guess which United States is the question. So that's the confusion that they.
What do you say? What about the United States?
The confusion is a citizen of which United States they're referring to?
Well, look at you. That's fraud.
The corporate or?
No. Don't worry about that. All that is fraud. It's negative. It's irrelevant. We're working off the Constitution where we, the people, ordained and established. And especially if you made that point, you already established what it is. You also established the fact that
records.
So we're under common law, and we're a common law nation. It falls under the foundation of our law, which is the Declaration of Independence, which all of our law is built upon that.
Mm-hmm.
And that brings us under God's law.
I stay away from all that in my paperwork. I didn't bring any of that up.
Just never argue citizenship and never deny it either. There's no reason to deny it, because you see, the word citizen is used 7 times in the Constitution. Okay, so it's something we shouldn't shy away from. There are a lot of people teaching things, and they make arguments, and it just gets more smoke and problems in the court and arguments. Who wants to get it? You want to get to the case and deal with it and get it over and move on. And but when you make these notes, when you make these points, if you have to make a point on a paper, or you did make a point, then you should put a footnote in there or make a reference in verbally speaking so that it's very clear. But they can imagine all they want. It doesn't change the fact that with the United States of America, what they'd done was illegal, unlawful. They didn't have no power, no authority. The only one that could break our covenant with God is God himself. No man can break that covenant. Declaration of Independence is a covenant with God. A lot of people don't realize that. We ask to be put under his blessings, to be under his law. And then you go into one of the 6 directives to all people that are bureaucrats, elected individuals, all the individuals that are servants, that they're there to secure the blessings of liberty. And that says it all. And it's written right there in the preamble of the United States Constitution. So, but we should move on to the next person. I'm starting to see we do have people in the queue now again. So,
cool.
Any
thanks,
final
God.
Word?
No, thanks. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we're going to go to Carson City, Nevada. Hang on. Give us your first name from Carson City, Nevada.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, hi. Okay, my situation is
first name.
Kind of. I'm sorry.
What's your first name?
Sue.
Okay, go ahead, Sue.
Okay, basically, my situation is it's a fraudulent foreclosure attempt. It started out where I literally had just modified a note. And literally, this was in probably 2015, 2016. Anyway, I had just modified the note, and for some reason, I don't even remember what had happened, but I became unemployed at that point in time. Requested an unemployment forbearance where I had to kind of make payments, and they were half payments, and at the end, I needed to pay them, you know, a few thousand dollars just to bring the thing current. Well, all of a sudden, what should have been like maybe $3,000, max $4,000, turns into like $14,000. And I said, no, I don't owe you $14,000. Now, had it been a different time where I had not just modified, I probably, you know, would have more than likely gone along with it, but I had just modified, so I knew I didn't owe them that. And between one thing and another,
you modified a mortgage, is that what you're saying?
I modified a mortgage, correct.
And what modifications did you make?
Well, okay, so basically at that point I had modified the mortgage, changed the interest rate and some of the terms of the mortgage. Anyway, so they decided to literally take on my insurance, on my escrows, instead of charging me for one insurance policy, because they wouldn't explain to me where they got this additional, like, $14,000 from. And I told them, I don't owe you $14,000. I'm not going to pay you what I don't owe you. This is like an extortion attempt. Anyway,
you know, what you need to do, you need to go to your state, you wouldn't find it in your state constitution, but your state page, you know, you're in Nevada, right? Let me see. Is that
I'm actually in Florida. I just have a Nevada number.
Okay. Well, you're where? What state?
Florida.
Florida. Okay. Well, go to the Florida state page and start looking for some information there to get some things on usury, for instance. You want to look into usury, because right there, you know, where did that $14,000 come from? The other thing is, you know, if you put in form 4490, you'll get a federal form. It's called a proof of claim. And any time anybody is making a claim against you, particularly if they are particularly if it's government or if it is this the bank or who's doing this? Who are you dealing with?
This is a bank. Well, okay, the bank. Well, it's several banks.
Well, what you need is a proof of claim. Find out if there's a form to be used in that state for proof of claim. There is a federal form, and you can use a federal form in a state court. You can bring that up, and it's form. You actually write. Go into your search engine and put form form space 4490. I think it's 4490. Yes, 4490, and. And then, you know, you look down and you'll see something that says proof of claim, and you'll see PDF. When you click on the PDF, that'll be actually the form itself, and you can have that, you know, print that out and use that and give them that if you can't find some kind of a proof of claim form. Now, proof of claim has to itemize exactly what's going on, what kind of money they're looking for, so on and so forth, and it has to be notarized. So it's a document, and there can be no case opened up without an affidavit, although I see cases open up all the time without affidavits. That's unlawful. But in any event, that's one of the things you want to do. The other thing is if it's a mortgage, and are they trying to foreclose on you or just chase you for money for trying to foreclose?
No. So what ended up happening after I refused to pay them the lump sum that they were claiming, but I continued to pay the mortgage at that point, like a year and a half later, they decided, that's it, we're not taking your money anymore. And literally, I would take and FedEx the checks to them, so I have records of all of that, where they received it and signed for it. And then they started sending my checks back to me. So I have three checks where they have literally sent them back to me with an attorney's letter telling me that I am in default and they are no longer taking my checks.
Well, what you want to do is send them a notice and demand to lay out everything. You want to know exactly what it is, what's your proof of claim, how much do I owe, where you're getting the interest from, how does it come together, and how am I in default?
Okay, well, they've sent me stuff. I don't know if it's really a proof of claim. I will find that out.
Well,
let's
go back to proof of claim. Is it notarized on the bottom of the claim?
Okay, I will check that.
If
because basically at this point, it's been like 6 years, so they're claiming I owe them $140,000.
All right.
On top of...
First of all, they can't foreclose. You know, we have, I've done quite a bit in our course on non-judicial foreclosures, whether it's the bank or whether it's, the county, the town or whoever's foreclosing on you, not paying the taxes or whatever. So it could be a tax foreclosure, it could be a mortgage foreclosure. In any event, both of them are unlawful. And we wrote a very pointed, I don't want to use the word extensive, but it is, I guess you could say that to a degree. It's probably about 10 pages or 12 pages, and it lays out the law, and it lays out the crime of non-judicial foreclosures. And now some states have actually got their legislators to write up legislation to legalize a non-judicial foreclosure. Well, you can't legalize something that's illegal, so that doesn't mean anything anyway. Non-judicial foreclosure is a denial of due rights. They come in and just take your property and do what they please without giving you due process. And so you can then, you see, if you start arguing that case, you can then move it eventually into federal court for cause. And, there's no, and whatever court that you might find yourself into, it'll probably be a town court. Or a city, what are you in, a town? Are you in a city? What are you in?
I'm in actually Miami-Dade County.
Okay.
Now, in my situation, what happened was in one calendar year, they decided to charge me for like four or five insurance policies. And they never told me, but that's where that 14,000 and some came from. And I actually found an escrow statement. I mean, literally.
Well, you had your own insurance on that mortgage, didn't you? Didn't you have your insurance on your property for your mortgage?
My mortgage was PITI, so it's principal, interest, taxes, and insurance. I had my own policy, but they would pay it. So what they did was they paid my policy. Well, they paid two policies. Okay. And then they put
I don't want to get too deep into the case on those issues and things. I just want to work on general issues, and you can beat this on general issues. Again, the non-judicial foreclosure. I was looking to see if I had a free one up here, because I have a page here under the educational tab, and you come down to law, and then underneath law, you'll find court forms and process. And I have some examples here for going into the court. I thought I had something. Maybe I'll put something up here on non-judicial foreclosures. I don't think I have anything here. Let me just do a search. A memorandum of non-judicial foreclosure. Let's see. We do have that up here. Let's see what that should be pretty powerful in itself. Okay. All right. So memorandum of a non-judicial foreclosure we do have. You can get a lot from that, okay? Memorandum of law and under this purpose of this memorandum. Let's see how many pages this is. I don't remember. Enable editing. Okay, it's about seven pages. This in itself is a case. You could use this as a case in opposed to a memorandum. Although you can take your case and then attach the memorandum, so that's something to do. But this lays out the fraud. It makes it clear. It's unlawful.
Well, okay, so basically they, at this stage, I don't know if you're familiar with the CFPB.
No, not.
I think that's probably national. Okay, it's called the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Okay.
Because when I found out about what you know, I found the escrow statement, and I sent it to them requesting that they correct it. They refused, point blank refused to correct it. So yeah. Then I filed something with the CFPB.
Again, we can't get too deep into those things. Obviously, you know that's wrong. They have to respond to everything. You're not in court, though. This is just paperwork going back and forth, right?
This is paperwork right now, but to block the foreclosure, because the attorney that I had previously, I guess he figured that, I probably had a very good situation where they wouldn't win in court. He actually started helping them on my dime.
Hmm.
And literally, it got to the point.
This is what I suggest that you do. It's in the paperwork where they're going to go back and forth with paper. It's time to take get away from being the defensive and going on to the offensive. And in order to do that, you really want to bring in a notice and demand. And I would do the notice and demand with a summons on top of it. I've never done that before, but a lot of these lawyers, they ignore it. So I'm thinking, put a summons on it. You're being summoned to answer. You know, you're not going to court, but you're being summoned to answer this, and this is a notice and demand. You can make it fancy on the top like you would on a court case, but it's basically a notice and demand. And then you put your issues in there. There are 8 points, I believe, to a notice and demand. You can get, again, a copy of that on our website underneath the law page that I had mentioned. Get it to the lawyer. You give them 30 days to answer. Okay. Yep. You make it just official like you were doing a summons. You got 30 days to answer. You get all your paperwork together, and you want answers. And again, there are 8 points. They have to address all 8 points. Once they fail to do that, okay, then you send them a default, okay? And then at that point, if they're not going to respond to that, then you move it into your state court for cause. What you're going to do really is sue them, but you're going straight for a summary judgment for failing to respond. And they can have the opportunity to respond in the court. Maybe the judge might say, hey, let's see if they respond. But if you open a court of record, you're looking for a jury, so you don't want the judge to make any decisions. That's another argument and another problem in the courts, because judges, either they don't understand it or they don't want to understand it. But in any event, you know, that's the way that I would take this at some point, and you want to get ahead of them before them taking you to court. You want to take them to court. They're not answering you. You have to do that because they're getting ready to really, come out after you and set you up. They're trying to probably get you to acquiesce to certain things. So you make sure that you've answered everything that they sent you.
That's basically what it is in a nutshell. Now, the funny thing is they've actually sold the loan to someone else.
Well, without your approval, it's not a loan. You have to understand how this system works. First of all, the bank has no skin in the game. Any financial services, banks, whatever, that takes on these mortgages, they sell them in packages and stuff. All that is illegal. We lay that out in the non-judicial foreclosures and how they went this process. When the bank set the loan, or whoever a financial institution set the loan, they got their point or two or three or whatever they took off of that. Usually it's a point or two. And they go to the Fed window for the money. They have no skin in the game. They didn't have any money in the game. And certainly the people who bought these things have no skin in the game. You have no agreement with them. There's no meeting of the mind. There is no contract. It was a mortgage came from the federal window, from the Fed. So what happens is when people go through that process, and then the bank starts collecting the money off it, and of course the Fed gets their due because, you know, they get a piece of the action. It's within taxes or whatever the case may be. It's not necessarily, or it could be. I don't know. However, they work that out. But the bottom line is they don't really have the authority to do that, and the whole thing is fraud. And again, if you read the memorandum, you'll see the fraud if you carefully go through it slowly and come to an understanding. If you have to, go online, use your dictionary and find out the meaning of things and go through that paper, and you'll see how they did the fraud. Okay?
Right.
That's where you want to go. We got a lot of people in the queue. It is starting to get late, so I want to move on. Okay? But, see how work that out and come back another time. And
yeah,
talk
I, I have some additional questions. Could I email you with those?
Well, the best thing to do is send it to questions@nationallibertyalliance.org, mm-hmm. and then we'll answer it next Monday.
Perfect.
Okay?
Great, okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, let's take our next caller. And by the way, people who are coming in on phones, I don't know if you have apps. We do have an app that you can use on your phone. And if you have an app, then you could be seeing our desktop here, and we go through some pages of some of the things we're talking about. It helps you to find the necessary paperwork that we're showing. But anyway, we'll take our next caller. It's Sula. How are you doing, Sula? Sulu from... Let's see, Missouri. Is it Missouri? Yeah.
Good evening, John.
Good.
Yes, I do have a question. When you was doing a course on the common law, I didn't really finish that. My husband and I didn't finish that. Is that still available online?
It'll be there forever. You'll always have access to it.
Okay, and we can use the code that they sent us to do that?
You don't need a code no more. You should be able to, as long as you're signed in, your name has already been checked off for access to certain pages, and that's the pages. All of the pages for the court access and the common law course is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, indefinitely. And you can take your time in the course. You can come back a year from it. It doesn't matter. Whenever you want to do it, you do it.
Okay, thank you. And my other question, where can I learn more about the common law trust? I know you have it on there. I read it, but I still kind of have questions about...
I don't have deep knowledge of it, but I have put together my own common law trust, and we put a lot of information. You really got to do some homework on the common law trust to put it together properly. I can't articulate the details of that as well as I can some other issues. But again, all the information you need is on our page under Education Starts Here. Come down to Law, and then under Law, you'll click on Court Forms and Process. And when you come to that page, then, of course, you'll find the information that you're looking for right there, right almost on the top, Common Law Trust. So we have a lot of stuff on that. And I'm trying to remember whether we covered any of that in the course. No, we didn't cover common law trust in the course. We really worked on due process in the common law.
Okay, so there is more information on there on the top of that of your common law trust. I know I read all the common law, your trust, but is there more to that? Is that what you're saying?
Well, everything I have is right here. It is also all the necessary paperwork. It's a lot of forms and stuff that you can work right through and create your own, whatever your personal information is. It's like a fill-in. Everything in the courts, most everything in the courts is done by forms. Or you can make your own. I take forms and I'll use forms, and sometimes I'll use their forms and change it around, make it my own. Forms are good because it puts everybody on the same page.
So do you have any suggestions on maybe where I can get further, more education on that? Or just look up to your...
I mean, there's a lot of hidden stuff on this. You got to be careful online. I've seen so many people talking online, different things, and they're giving bad information now, bad ideas and things. People are doing silly things and they don't realize it, so you got to be careful. You could talk to a lawyer, but the problem with the lawyer is they're civilly minded, so you're getting away from the common law side. And even with a lawyer that has a background in common law, which is very rare, they might get confused a little. I happen to know one that did, in my opinion, is a little confused on the process because it's different. A common law trust is very different than coming in from a civil law perspective to create a trust. But again, all the information that I have on it, and I use this information to write my own trust, so I've already done it.
Oh, okay.
and the forms are right there. Everything's there. You just run right through it. But you should understand what you're doing. It's going to be a little difficult opening it up in a bank. They don't like to open the banks. The banks don't like to open these trusts up. They ask for certain information that's none of their business. And so
it's right. Okay. So okay. So your the trust that you have, which is it's non.
It's an irrevocable trust.
Yes, it's a is irrevocable trust. So that means whatever information I put in, I can't change it. Is that what that is?
The revocable trust too. We got both in there, I believe. I see that. Just I got the template for the irrevocable trust, but. You could make it a revocable trust.
Okay. Oh, okay then. All right. Thank you. That's what I was wondering.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you, John.
We do have information on a revocable trust also, which is probably the one you want to do.
Okay. And that's on there too?
Yes, on the same page.
Thank you. I appreciate it. We appreciate you guys.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Okay.
Okay, Ross. We'll go to Ross next. You got the mic. Go ahead, Ross. You're on. You want to talk?
They just recently updated the UCC code to the Unified Commercial Code that if you're an investor, you don't own any assets at all.
I don't understand. Try it again.
I said UCC, Unified Commercial Code.
Okay.
Yeah. So you said just using update the code to that the company owns all the assets when you invest.
The Universal Code is an equity. It's legislative law. That's what that is, and has nothing to do with you or me. It has to do with people who are operating under commercial activity or working for a government agency.
Yes. If you are going to Schwab, now Schwab owns your investments.
I missed that. Something about investments. I missed that.
Yes, investments. They just changed that code. Even if you purchase a stock, it's not yours, it's theirs.
Oh, well, again, I'm not sure I understand, but in this case, for instance, you don't really own a home, ultimately, you're still kind of renting, and if you don't pay your taxes, they're going to come take it away, so in a sense, you're renting your home. The thing with a car, for instance, you don't really own your car. By the state or however they work that out, I don't know, but they claim that you don't own it. It's just
what he's talking about is when you put money in the bank now, it's not your money. They say that they own it, that you're investing with them, and when they lose, you lose. This is something.
That's absolutely correct. And again, it's just another fraud game.
That's
and,
right.
If you look under signature, I don't have that on my checks because I'm in a credit union, and maybe that's why I don't see it. But, Gerard, do you have a check to read what's under, or are you in a credit union too?
What's that?
Where your signature goes, they put in these tiny letters. Let me see.
It's authorized signature or something.
Look, it's a line, and this is what it says, if I can read it.
It's just over and over again, authorized signature.
Is that what it says?
Pretty sure.
Well, I thought it said something more.
Check.
Yes, even with my magnifying glass, I still can't make it out. But whatever it is, for me, that itself, look, that's so tiny, you should be able to read that. That's so tiny. Again, that brings you to more fraud, more hidden information. And I do have it, even on my credit union.
Yes?
You want to take the mic for a while, Gerard?
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Like, I just opened a Schwab account for Charles Schwab's.
Yeah.
To do investments. They say... Now, the Schwab owns the stock you purchase. You don't own the stock at all.
Yeah, that's a fraud. That's what they're doing because they can get away with it, because we have no accountability in our government. We have a two-tiered system, so they're doing fraud and getting away with it.
And why we don't make them accountable for that?
You know what? Good luck. I would say if you're going to do that, I take my money out. That's how you do not participate. That would cure them overnight. If everybody said, we're not giving you our money until you remove that erroneous, tyrannical rule that you got. It's not your money, it's my money.
People should take their money out of the bank. The banks are ready to fold. I mean, you should just leave enough money to get you through the month for paying your bills. Matter of fact, when you put your money in the bank, you should pay your bills right away and then not put any more money in the bank. You should keep, because look at, even though your dollar is becoming worthless, at some point in time, whatever dollars you have left over at the end of the day, will probably be restored for the true value of that dollar, a real dollar value, for whatever dollars you physically have. Now, I know with coins, because coins is U.S. printed, they're coined U.S., and that still kind of comes from the U.S. Treasury, even though they play the ink game. It doesn't matter. It's all fraud. The bottom line is they still have value. It follows whatever the metal makeup in that coin is irrelevant. It's really the security of the United States to guarantee it, just like the dollar is guaranteed by the Fed, Federal Reserve, which it isn't federal, nor do they have reserves, and they don't guarantee it anyway. But the coins, they'll have value in a collapsed society. It may take a while before it's accepted as value, but definitely by the end of the day, it will be by value. And remember, the metal value inside the coin does not ride with, does not change as inflation changes. The once they got rid of the silver out of the silver dollar and the silver half dollar and the quarters and the dimes, once they took the silver out of that, but you still have some copper and you have other metals, and it held a value, and we had more and more inflation, so it made less of value. But if it went the other direction, it would follow the other direction. So it'll have the full face value at some point in time. So I get half dollars. I buy lots of half dollars. Go to the bank, a dollar for a dollar. Get $2 half for every dollar you put in there. But that's a real dollar now on a collapsed society, and when you get to the other end coming out of it, it's going to have value. And it may even have value during the time while we're in that period of time where the inflation is so heavy. Who knows how that's going to work? We're in uncharted waters. So the other thing, of course, is buying silver. But I definitely don't leave money in the bank. I wouldn't put into any investments at this point in time, because when they all collapse, you're going to lose everything with them.
Okay. Thank you.
Hey.
Okay.
Don't hit the wrong button now.
Yeah. and Bold Pony's saying the banks are gonna go down. I think he's saying around Passover is gonna be this fall. You're gonna see some major stuff. Evergreen Bank. I do too. Well, look at that big bank and SBC, South China Bank, SBCC. I don't know. What it is.
I've seen those letters somewhere.
And that's bankrupt. And Evergreen is bankrupt. Evergreen, that has worldwide implications, and they're not even talking about it. So we're just dead man walking right now. I wouldn't put any money in the bank, but that's me.
To pay your bill, you write the check, put the money in at the same time, a day or two later the money's out, moved into someone's account. That's it, you're done, you paid your bill.
Anyway, I guess Tim is up. Tim, are you can you hear?
Yes.
You're unmuted.
Yes. Give us your state, Tim.
Connecticut.
How you doing, Tim? Go ahead.
Hey, how are you, John? Okay, so yesterday or something, or day before yesterday, I watched a video in relation to the quo warranto for the federal the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
And then I saw listed on there other court, other actions at law, I'll call them other suits, and I was interested in maybe perusing some of those, but I couldn't. I tried to search the site, and I couldn't find them. There's like one in the IRS, and then there's.
I think if you are you a paying member, $5 a month or more.
The mail pages are restricted anymore, Gerard. Just recently, I took the last page out. Every page is available, with the exception of the courses. You know, some courses require you to be a premium member, which is $5 a month or more. The basic courses are totally free; you just got to be a member. And then the law course, court access, and the common law, you have to be a premium member. It's given $5 a month or more, and it's $125 for that course. But that's a $200,000 course. You're going to learn everything a lawyer learns. Matter of fact, you learn more than a lawyer learns, and you're going to learn the common law with it. So you have the whole thing together. But the pages that you're looking for, okay, Tim, if you go to federal court cases on the top right-hand side on the blue bar, and you come down to action against the judiciary, okay, and you'll see all the papers that we had filed in the federal court, okay, and this is our evidence also. That's why we did all this work to file all these cases. We didn't expect to win. We were hoping to win some, but we won, you know, just a few, maybe habeas corpuses and a few other things. But generally speaking, we didn't win anything in this case, which is this is going to become an indictment on the federal judiciary. So the paper you're looking for, which is the writ quo warranto, was filed on February 19, 2020, so just look down on the date right on the top, and when you click on that, you'll get a copy of that writ quo warranto. It's a 9-page paper. It may have some attachments to it, you know, referring to memorandums. Anybody learning to write, once you go through the courses, you want to learn to write, you learn by reading cases, reading other people's cases, okay? And so we have a lot of cases we've written over the past X amount of years. I don't know how long we've been writing cases on this, since 2016, I believe. So we probably were doing things before that, but generally 2016. So that's 4, 5, 6. We've got 7 years of cases up here, and you can learn from this. I think we have, they're all in Word. We put it up here in Word so that you know, you can manipulate it yourself. You can cut and paste, and all of the footnotes and everything follow with you. And if you don't know how to use footnotes, we do give some instruction in our course on and reference to places where you can learn how to use Microsoft Word. But let me give you a quick example. If you come under, let's see, well, you can't get to this page unless you're in a course, but I'll give you the information out anyway. Under the course access and the common law, there's two pages that you get if you signed into this course, and these pages are there indefinitely, as I mentioned a little earlier. You come into the course, it'll be there as long as we're here, and we intend on being here for far beyond the saving of the nation. We'll continue to educate and build people, to educate the people on a grassroots level. So an educated grassroots, let's say that. But on the recorded, it'll be on the table of contents, I think. But I'll give you the info on the bottom. We have some places that you can get. You can go to YouTube and put in Word for Beginners, which is MS Word for Beginners, Word for Beginners. There's quite a few courses out here on how to use Microsoft Word. And it'll show you how to use footnotes, how to do all kinds of different things that you really need in order to make pristine paperwork. The other thing is PowerPoint.
I have an Apple computer. I guess I wouldn't know.
You should be able to get something with Word. I understand that they have things that work with the Apple. But it's also PowerPoint. If you're going to be litigating court cases, you definitely want to be proficient in PowerPoint. So Microsoft Word and PowerPoint are an absolute necessity. And reading other cases, and then once you're using the PowerPoint, once you're using the Microsoft Word or whatever is equal to that, you'll see how you can cut and paste. and carry over all of the footnotes and everything with it, and you can alter the footnotes, you can add to them, and whatever you want to do. You make your own footnotes, blah, 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 blah. But you learn to write by reading. If you look at my older cases, and then you look at the newer cases, you can see I've grown tremendously, okay? Because the more you read, the more you work with it, the more you write, the more you review, you just become better and better, you know? But anyway, let me pass the mic back to Gerard.
Okay, I wanted to, it was in relation to the relation to the original question I asked. I accessed that suit, the action at law. It was through a video, actually. You had made it into a video also. I mean, apparently also. And then so I was curious whether any of those other there's more explaining this goes on in videos and so forth. I was curious whether any of those other actions at law that you brought up that are available in the PDF form that you showed just a few minutes ago, I wondered whether you did any of those in video, and you elaborated those in video.
Yeah, I'm looking to see. Maybe under educational videos I might have done some. I'm looking to see right now. Slavery in America, Court Access in the Common Law Course, Introduction, Democracy versus Republic. That is actually a paper that I've written, and we're going to be, because we need to go back to a republic. We're going after the federal courts. So we've got the seminar up here, Founding Fathers, Slavery. This would be under education, and come down to, where was that? Those
educational videos, right? Educational videos.
Yeah, there it is. Yeah, right there, educational videos. Now, they'll probably be here. The other thing is to visit our YouTube page, which we have set up there, and we have. You go to our Rumble page, because whatever we have here would have been on Rumble or YouTube, but they'd be far back. You know, I just did a long course on the Book of Revelation for Bible studies, because we do Bible studies here, and you'll find that under Education Bible Studies. And so when you go into looking at Rumble, for instance, you're going to see a lot of Bible studies, because we've been putting up two a week. But you keep going down to the bottom, and then you'll start to get to other things. And in between, you might find some other things that we put out there. Maybe we can find a way, Gerard, to divide the Bible studies from the other things, and so it might be easy to find somehow, I don't know. But in any event, it's all there. And everything we have up there, we've done it in order to put the video onto the website. So all those videos are on our website also. So we have the ABA and the Abrogation of the Common Law here. We have Amendment 2, Virtue America's Foundation, Common Law, County Sheriff, the County Committee of Safety. But this isn't the only place we have videos. Videos are splattered throughout our website, so you're going to find a lot of stuff, and you'll find a lot of videos up on our civics course. Anybody who wants to understand how America came to be where we're at, as far as being destroyed, our courts being destroyed, a political process being destroyed, how did this happen, how did we get here, that's answered in our civics course through videos, mostly by Griffin, with G. Edward Griffin. But we also have other videos that also help to teach what's going on here. We in that civics course we have the Constitution. I'm trying to think of the guy's name. He's slipping my mind, Gerard. The course, Bad Derek, or Bad goodness.
What's that again?
Trying to think of the name that did this.
Michael Badnarik.
Badnarik, yeah.
Thank you. So we've got that in there also. Gerard and I took that course live. Did we do that twice or just once? I don't remember.
I think I did it twice. My brother bought it. I don't know. It was a while ago.
No, but we actually went to his live course, remember? He did
once. I didn't do that twice.
Yeah. Anyway, he's passed, though, hasn't he? I heard.
Yeah, he passed away, yeah.
Anyway, lots of stuff up there, lots of videos. But go to our Rumble page, and I have two or three YouTube that haven't been taken down. I still have some with old videos on it, which lots of them, but I'm trying to think. I don't have a link to them. I'll have to find a link and put it up on our YouTube link. But anyway.
Okay. Thank you, Dan.
Got it, Tim. Thanks.
Go ahead. What's that? He's low. You blast me away, and he's so low, I got turned up.
Yeah, I had it turned up, too. But you go ahead to the next caller. I think it's Robert.
Okay. Robert, will you? Robert, 765.
Yeah.
Hello, I'm here.
Yeah, what state are you in, Robert?
I'm in Minnesota.
Okay. What's up tonight?
Going to court this month. The DNR decided to walk on my property. I was up hunting raccoons because they were getting into my chicken coop, and she walked up and didn't ask me what I was doing, didn't ask me for any ammunition I had in my gun, lowered my gun down. She grabbed it and then started to write tickets for not having a deer license and supposedly hunting over bait. Well, I take all my chicken manure and feed and everything that the chickens don't want. I throw it on my trails to feed the grass and stuff like that, so at least they have something to eat. And then they decided to I'll go to court about it. And
court.
From what I've seen through Barker versus Wingo, which I brought up to the judge, that they had 100 days to bring me into court, and from the day I came into court was 124 days. And he says, well, those are just numbers. It don't mean nothing.
What court? What kind of court?
County court.
County court, right?
Aiken, Minnesota.
But what was this woman? She was a forester?
DNR.
What's DNR? I'm not familiar with that.
Department of Natural Resources. A wannabe
cop. That's a federal agency then.
I guess, yeah.
Well, guess what? They have no jurisdiction. The Supreme Court already ruled that earlier last year, that they're administrative. I mean, I don't know if you want to go there, but technically they have no jurisdiction over you.
Yeah, they can't fine or incarcerate it.
No. She's out of her. You know, you got to challenge jurisdiction on this one, and you should cite that case that they just stated this past year. When Roe versus Wade went down, which was like a year, that case, within a week or two, the Supreme Court, there was another case that had to do with Encon or one of those, and basically the Supreme Court said, all you agencies, you have no authority over we the people. Those are only people that have contracts with you. So like a government contractor stuff, they're the only ones that they have jurisdiction over. So she can't be coming on your property and writing you tickets and taking you to court. And that's what I would stick with. And, you know, you go in there and put that evidence in and then take it right to federal court, because they do not have any kind of jurisdiction over you, and that should get thrown out.
Okay, because they plan on having, because I told them I'm not settling, and they got a jury trial set up for February 13th.
They actually gave you a jury trial. That's interesting.
Hold it. Then there must be an indictment. Where's your indictment? And are you facing potential criminal charges?
Yeah, for the state of Minnesota versus me.
Well, call up the prosecutor tomorrow and ask him, for a copy of the indictment. They probably didn't indict. Then you move it to federal court for cause and have it thrown out. That's number one. Number two, you want to go into your constitution and see if county courts are courts of record. Number three, even if they are courts of record, are they operating as a court of record? Okay, and if you do up it, they do claim to operate it, and you are kind of stuck in it, then you want to be able to deal with the jury. You want to make sure that it is a fully informed jury. And you do that by putting fully informed jury information into your paperwork when you're responding. You do an attachment and maybe attach our book to give them, let's see, if you go underneath education, start a committee of safety, and you come down, you come down to handbook, videos, and tools, okay? And you'll see here, you'll see the common law handbooks. A lot of them, we have the organization structure, the charter, the committee man handbook, the organizing handbook, resolution, the vow, common law handbook, the elected officials handbook, and then we got the grand jury handbook, and we have also the petit jury handbook. So you click on the petit jury handbook. It's 41 pages, a PDF download. It's free. You know, if you wanted to buy the pocket one for, your own knowledge and keeping, you can do that up on Amazon. Just go to our books on our page and you'll get a link to it. But you can get the PDF copy. It's 8.5 by 11, full sheet papers, 41 pages. And you attach that in your paperwork. And again, are you taking the course? Court access?
Yes.
So, okay, then you're going to find the structure inside there and information and how you attach papers and reference over to that. I just did a court case, two court cases going on now, really, really good paperwork, I think, and a lot of information you have, but couched in a different way, maybe a couple of little new things. But I'll get them up when I can. I just don't have the time to put it up there. So anytime I can update more information on that course, I'll stick it up there, and people can come and get that information too. But you want to get this handbook attached as a to fully inform your jury. And once it's in here as a memorandum, and you make the attachment. That's probably what you want to do. And so when you finally get into the case, now you can educate the jury because they've accepted your paperwork. Now lawyers are brain dead, most of them, so they may look at that and say, oh, these people are crazy, and they'll move on and not do anything about it. But if that lawyer is worth anything and wants to win and not give you your unalienable rights, they'll try to have that struck from the record. And you got to fight tooth and nail to keep that in that record, because once it's in the record, you can use it in the court. And once it's in the court, I'd come in with a PowerPoint to train the jury on exactly matter of fact, I'll do a PowerPoint eventually when I have time that people can use in the court for the purpose of educating the jury to make sure you do.
Okay, what was that book again under education?
Yeah, you come in here, you go under education. Education starts here. No, I'm sorry. Step back. Forget that. You come to start a committee of safety, and you come down to handbook, videos, and tools. And it's on the first. It's on the first list that says PDFs, and we also have some of it in Word, but it's on PDFs.
Okay. Organization structure.
Well, no, you want grand jury handbook. Okay.
Okay.
I'm sorry. No, petit jury handbook. So you want the petit jury handbook. I may have some information in the course. Well, let's move on, and when I get some information, I'll pop it up and just make a note. So whether you're still on the mic with us or not, I'll pop in if I can find it and just make a note, okay? But meanwhile, what else you got that Gerard can respond to?
They never indicted him?
Well, then there's no case.
Yeah, so there's a separate step. You wouldn't even have to get into the...
There has to be affidavits, okay? You're also going to find they probably have no affidavits. Now, you'll have what they claim to be an affidavit, but it's not sworn to, usually. I mean, it's possible they could swear to something, but usually it's unsworn. A lot of police forms and stuff are not sworn to, per se. So in order to move the charges through, every court case requires affidavits. But there are no affidavits, there's no court case.
Okay. All right. What about them having to go after those guys for not
not doing a speedy trial.
Well, that's
a statute, and that judge doesn't know what he's talking about because he's choosing to break a statute. He doesn't have that power.
And I would build that into it in the beginning, and that's the battle and then appeal that battle up, and you play in their civil law process. I mean, statutes don't apply to us, but look, it applies to them anyway, so apply it and make your point. And if there's a statute of limitations on this kind of a case over. And if the judge will not do it, okay, look, there's a lot of things you have to investigate on this. You have to go to your county. You have to go to your state constitution and see if counties are courts of record. That's number one. Number one thing you got to do. Okay, if it's not listed as a court of record, then it's a denial of due process. Now, if the judge is moving on, the other thing you want to find out is how many people are in the jury. A lot of times they'll run this with six individuals, or what are the numbers that are used, Rod? Do you know?
No, it's all crazy. Something of six and ten and four. They do whatever they want.
Right. So they got minimum people on. That's an unlawful jury. 12 is required with a spare wheel minimum. At least one spare wheel.
Right.
And I would think two would be much.
And that's very important. People don't realize how important that is. 12-man jury, you have less than a 0.005% chance of being wrongfully convicted. This is what our forefathers figured out. When you get up to a 6-man jury, it's about a 50 percentile, 50-50 that you could be wrongfully convicted. It goes exponentially as they remove jurors. Because don't forget, just one juror can hang the thing, you know?
Right. Yeah, all 12 have to agree. If they can't agree, they're stuck. And just because they're stuck doesn't mean that they get to go home. They stay there until they decide, well, we can't do anything. Let's find them not guilty. Okay? And then that's it. Because one person trips up the whole thing. That's the law. And that's to protect the innocent.
Right. Yeah. My wife just got off some grand from jury duty, and she was up to the last 12, and they were asking questions, and does anybody know the sheriff? And me and the sheriff get along real good. And she says, yeah, I went down when my husband was talking to the sheriff. Well, what does he talk about? I don't know. Whatever he talks about, I don't pay attention. And then he says, well, did your husband have some kind of case or something with the sheriff? He says, well, with DNR. Well, the case was with DNR because I had a couple Indians call up the gas pipe, a 3-foot gas pipe, 30 yards up in there, and the sheriff had to go in there and drag him out, so he had to go to court with him. But that was all that about. So it's like, oh, okay. What were the questions they asked you when you went to court, the jury? And I'm reading through your paperwork on tampering with the jury and stuff, and holy smoke, I mean, it was like a bomb went off.
Yeah. Listen, the other thing is your sheriff should be protecting you from this DNR. They have absolutely no jurisdiction, and if he's constitutional, he should tell them to get out of my county.
That's why it's important to buy your sheriff the book, Government by Consent. We have a large chapter in there just for sheriffs, okay? We also have handbooks for sheriffs, so we have the sheriff's handbook. You need to get them a copy
right.
of that. So
I just bought both of them, and Court Access and the Common Law.
Yeah, that's
so.
Good.
All right, yeah, everybody needs to educate the sheriff. And believe me, even if you don't have problems and you're not in court, you want an educated sheriff, and you want to get a sheriff that you know. I got my sheriff on speed dial, although the sheriff that I had, I met with him numerous times, he passed, so the undersheriff took over.
He's a really good constitutional sheriff. He's had quite a few of the guys, Chris Ann Hall. He's taught him and his deputies, and Sheriff Mack. He's been there here a couple times. So
he's got some really good knowledge then, probably. Get him the book.
Yeah, you should discuss this case with him. Gosh.
I sure will. I've been with him for the past year, talking with him about it. So
yeah. All right, we can move on. We're like overtime here.
Yeah, we got people right in the queue. So the next few callers, we're going to have to just a couple of minutes apiece if we can handle everyone, and we can pick up a little more on next week. But go ahead, Gerard.
Okay, let's see how it goes. Okay, I don't know. It just says wireless caller 559. Give me your name and your state. You've been unmuted. Go ahead.
First name, first state.
Yeah, this is a David. I'm in California.
Okay. That's
and
as bad as being in New York. Go ahead.
Well, that's where I grew up. But,
okay.
Here I am. Yeah.
Didn't learn your lesson. No. Yeah, what's your question?
Nonetheless, I just want to say, first of all, there was that lady that was asking about trust, and I wanted to recommend her to look up, to get a hold of Carlton Weiss' book, Weiss's Concise Trustee Handbook.
W-E-I-S-E?
W-E-I-S-S.
S-S. Carlton, yeah. C-A-R-L-T-O-N?
Yeah, Carlton Albert Weiss.
Okay, and he wrote a book.
Yes, yeah, it's very, very good. She'll get a lot out of it. I am a trustee for a number of clients myself, so just wanted to pass that along.
Hey, it's a PDF download.
Yeah, yes, it's
a Weiss Trustee Handbook, 99 pages. It looks pretty okay. I'm going to take a look at this. I won't be able to go through it thoroughly, but I'll be able to breeze through it and see what's going on. And if I think it's if I think it's got merit to it, I'll put it up on the website here with the other trust information.
Yeah, good, good. Glad to share that. The reason I'm calling is I have not I haven't been in a courtroom for a while, and another fellow.
I just want to make a note about this. Just starting off looking at this paper, and it's really nice if you can download it in a PDF form. It's got a lot of footnotes in here, and that warms my heart. It makes me, when you see someone that's putting footnotes, they're giving you the facts, you know what I mean?
Right,
so hopefully
right.
It's mostly focusing in on the common law side of things, but facts are important, and court cases are important, particularly on the Supreme Court end. But go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yes, sir. Yeah. A guy got a guy's gotten a hold of me. He's a trustee for a trust. He hasn't done a very good job. What's happened is that he appointed a family member, a cousin of his, to rent a residence, for some income, and the renter is in default, hasn't paid rent for a while, and actually been living there for a while, pretty rent free. So he's asked me to help him out with an unlawful retainer action, and so I'm just was wondering about anybody familiar with that and kind of what I might want to expect and share with this guy going into filing this unlawful retainer as a trustee.
I'm sorry, I missed the question. I was busy looking at this. Say the question again.
Filing an unlawful detainer for a trust.
Well, if something's filed that's unlawful, I mean, I don't know particularly what was the essence of the retainer.
There is a renter in a property owned by a trust who's in breach of contract, hasn't paid rent for over a year, I think, or longer. I'm just kind of getting the details on this. And he's asking my help to file an unlawful detainer against the renter. I know we have to give him notice to pay or quit and that kind of stuff, but I don't think they're going to. He suspects they're not going to respond to that because they've been asking her for rent and nothing's been happening. So we've got to file something in court and get the sheriff to get her out of there.
Yeah, that should be a simple process. It's done.
Yeah, you give the 30-day notice and then when they don't do anything, then you get the sheriff to give her a 3-day notice. That's how it is over here. I don't know what it is over by you. They'll come and unload the stuff on the sidewalk. That's it. End of story. The only thing is when COVID was here, they stopped everybody from doing that illegally, unconstitutionally, because they didn't give the land owner any consideration. They can't do that. They can't have you renting your place for free. I mean, unless they're going to restitute it. So they're going to end up paying that. The federal government's going to get nabbed for all that crap when this all flushes out, but that doesn't help you right now, you know.
Right.
Right.
I mean, were you under any of that when he wasn't paying? Were you under those COVID restrictions? Because that's another venue for you to get restitution.
Yes.
So they told you couldn't kick them out and blah blah blah.
Well, I don't think that was the issue.
They did it statewide here. The governor declared it, and that's what it was. You know what I mean? So I don't know what they did over there. Most states followed suit, but you'd have to research it.
By the way, this paper by Carlton Weiss, this is all irrevocable trusts.
Right.
A more powerful trust for the individual putting it in is a revocable.
Looks pretty good, too, doesn't it?
Well, there's no revocable trust. It's an irrevocable trust. Mine is a revocable trust. You know, I can revoke it at any time I want.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the important part. You know, so both have merit for whatever it is that you're doing, depending on what you're setting up.
Exactly. It depends on what your goals are.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we got to move on because we still have people in the queue and it's late, so... Any final word or thought or question or something?
Just would you elaborate on that COVID stuff a little bit more, where I should go look up, research it a little bit?
Well, it would have been under any emergency executive orders put out by the governor statewide. Uh-huh. So that's where I would go to the state and look up executive orders, emergency executive orders, and you should find it there. Most of them did it. They wouldn't let them kick anybody out, and I think all 50 states probably did that, but I don't know for sure. So you need to find out if that's the case, because you'll want to sue the state government when the time comes for that back rent also, and for violating your rights, basically.
And by the way, this book is a concise trustee handbook. I don't know that it's necessarily setting up the trust, but given information, it appears a guide to the administration, okay, of an express trust under the common law. So just to make the point, this is not helpful in creating the trust, but it's helpful of the administration of the trust. So that's what this handbook is for. And I'm going to go through it and see if it could be done. And I'm sure it is useful on either one, revocable or irrevocable. The only difference is one can be revoked. Okay.
Right. Yeah. All right, then. Thanks for the info.
Okay. Very good.
Appreciate it.
Let me get back to my screen here. Okay, next question is Linda in Virginia, it looks like. You're unmuted. Going once. I don't hear you snoring. You're unmuted.
I'm sorry, I had to unmute it.
Okay.
Yes.
Go ahead,
yes,
Linda.
Yes, Linda. Linda in Virginia.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not very timely because I just had a comment to the lady that called in about the loan modification and imminent foreclosure, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Virginia has it's called the State Corporation Commission, and they have a banking, department, banking and insurance.
Okay.
And you can file a complaint. So I was just going to say that's what she needs to look for in, Florida.
Mm-hmm.
I believe there's, something here called, I think I've lost it now. Florida Department of Financial something. And it does say you can file a complaint, but I don't know, it adds that they don't get involved in individual cases. But if what they're doing is fraudulent, I'm sure that, might be of benefit to file a complaint. The idea is to file a complaint anywhere you can find, get a record.
Right.
Of it. And once you have it written up, the facts and everything, that's what I do is start with the facts, pretty much stick to the facts.
Yeah.
And then you might have a little summary at the bottom or something, but just facts, only facts and evidence,
Hey, you're Sergeant Friday. Just the facts, ma'am.
Just the facts. That's it. Yeah. People want to put emotions and opinions and, all this, and it just doesn't belong there,
Everybody wants to tell their story, but it doesn't help the case.
No, it doesn't. And it basically clouds the case, So, but once you have it written up, you can, go with it and, post it to a lot of different places.
Right. Okay. Thank you for that.
All right. That's all I had to say.
Okay. Thank you very much. Have a good night. Next
Thanks.
Question. Anthony, West Virginia. Go ahead.
Hello, Gerard. Anthony here from West Virginia. How you doing?
Good, good.
I called earlier. It's going good. Did you receive a telephone call from me? It would have been a robocall with my voice on it.
I might have, but if it came on my cell phone, I probably didn't answer it. If I didn't know the number, I screened him.
I'm just trying to find your name on the. I did 25 telephone numbers, and I did send one to myself, and I just listened to. I just listened to the message that I sent to myself. And, it's not the best message in the world, but it's passable for what we're doing, especially for a test. I think it worked for a test fairly well. I'm not really that happy with the outgoing message, but it wasn't really a bomb.
So what day was that call?
I'm wondering if people heard it.
What day was that call?
February 1st. February 1st. And my report here, I don't have numbers. So I've got one voicemail, one no answer, another voicemail. It'll tell you whether you had a voicemail or a live answer. Ed gave a live answer. That's his 7147 number. John didn't get the call. Terry's got two numbers. One of them had a voicemail. I don't see you on here, Gerard. Did I miss your name? Let's see.
Maybe. I got some strange numbers here. One from Riverside, California. What a
yeah,
night.
I don't think you have your number up on the directory page. It's probably one.
I don't think I have your number, Gerard.
Oh. I might not have put it in. I don't know.
He's not up in the directory, I don't think.
I don't have Eric on here either. Somehow I didn't have his number.
Well, if I put any number up there, it would be my Skype number.
What's the first three digits on my number that you have? You know, don't give the whole number, and I don't need to hear it.
Let me see what I got. I have a couple of Johns on here. I don't think they're both you. One of them's a John Zub. John, I've got engine 3-4. A prefix 405. That's California.
Yeah,
mine would be either 229 number or 233 number. Those are the two numbers that I have.
I thought sure I had you on here. 239?
Nope.
229.
I got 229 and 233.
I don't see either one of those. I thought sure I had your name on here.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't send you a call, John. I guess I didn't have your number.
That's probably why I didn't receive it. What do you think?
That's probably why I didn't receive it. Anyway, we got Jan left. There were two calls and finally left a voicemail to Jan. Gary, there were three calls and no answer. Is there a Galen?
Yep.
9150?
Yeah, I don't know, but there's a Galen.
And a Jeff. Jeff had a voicemail answer. Anyway, I'd love to get some feedback on this. I think it should work. At least what it's doing for me is now I can look at a live answer and I know the people who are picking up the phone.
Yeah, if you got Jan's number on there, he'll probably comment on it when he's back next week, maybe.
Okay. Well, I'll call next week. Let you guys go. It's late, man.
Yep. Okay.
Just wanted to share that real quick. Talk to you guys next week.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Anthony.
Thank you. Bye, John. Bye-bye, guys.
Bye.
Okay. Next question from Greenfield, New Hampshire. Go ahead. 603. You've been unmuted, 603.
Okay, Green? I'm unmuted.
There you go.
Thank you. I'm involved in a guardianship case, and I'm trying to actually put together a brief. I'm representing myself. It's an appeal, and I'm going before the New Hampshire Supreme Court.
What kind of guardian?
Excuse me?
You're a guardian to someone? Someone took a guardianship of someone else? Or what's going on with that?
No, what it is, an appeal. I had petitioned guardianship for my mom, who has...
Hold on. You were petitioning for a guardianship?
I petitioned in the probate court for guardianship.
Big mistake. Big mistake. You don't need to go there. All you need to do is get the approval from your mother. Is she coherent? Can she...
You know what? Well, actually, you know what? She had the beginning stages, really, of dementia. Back in July of 2022, she signed a power of attorney to me, but then my sister and my older brother said she wasn't of cognitive ability to do that. So
you need to explain to those the other children there. You need to explain to them that's a big mistake because they're putting your mother in jeopardy. Once these probate courts get a hold of you and they find out people don't know what they're doing, and if there's an estate there and a value, they're going to steal it.
Let me ask you something. Were you in probate court already before you applied for the guardianship? Or did you apply for it in probate court?
No, you know what? I used forms that I found online. And
I would withdraw them. Withdraw them. If you haven't had any hearing, nothing is established yet, you just file.
Oh, no. We had a hearing. You know, What happened was my sister took it to court. She put in a petition for guardianship. So I put in a petition, a competing petition for her, and my mother had a court appointed attorney, and that court appointed attorney spoke with her, and she told him, she said, well, you know, I'm not opposed to guardianship, but I want, you know, my daughter Susan, which is me, I want her to be my guardian. So when we go to court, he stands up and he says, you know, Elizabeth, that's my mom. She's not opposed to our guardianship, but she wants to start.
If you look into his eyes very, very deeply, you'll see dollar signs, because I can already tell you what he probably done, but go ahead.
Well, and so so he stood up in court and, you know, he said that, you know, she's not opposed to her guardian, but she wants Susan to be her guardian. Well, they proceeded, though, to find my mother incapacitated. You know, they went through the petitions and found her, quote-unquote, incapacitated, which at that point it didn't matter what she said, because she, all of a sudden, she didn't have a voice, because she's incapacitated.
And that boy became the guardian, didn't he?
Well, no. What happened was that lawyer did absolutely nothing, which was part of my appeal, was that, you know, I mean, I'm looking into this. I'm saying, you know, he should have put in forms. He should have filed forms for her.
Well, before, forget about all that, because the whole thing is nothing but just evil processes. It just, you got to stay far away from probate court.
Here's the thing.
You said that you had paperwork as power of attorney from the past, and that has not been revoked by your mother or challenged by any of the siblings?
It was challenged because they said that she did not have the cognitive ability to sign.
No. Who challenged it?
The sister.
My sister. My sister challenged it. Hold on a minute,
because you've got a serious problem here. Does she have a big estate? Millions or hundreds of thousands or anything?
Yeah, hundreds of thousands.
Okay, so you got all the thieves looking at this to suck that up, and they'll spend every dollar that they can until she's a pauper and then walk away. You know,
I can't tell you. It's been probably $100,000 that just sucked.
Oh, yeah, they spent it like crazy.
What happened was when the power of attorney was signed, unfortunately, when I had all the documents signed and I went to a notary, there was a section on the document where we wrote in her name and a signature had to be in that spot. So it ended up that the power of attorney wasn't, the lawyer saw that the power of attorney was not valid anyways. But anyways, the court, it proceeded was that, the other siblings
Hold on. Who gave fiduciary authority to who to have control of your mother's estate?
The probate judge.
Okay, but who gave the fiduciary authority to the probate judge? Did the family give up their rights to take care of their own family? You see, look, I see this a lot in the probate courts. It's always the families, and what they do is they have no clue what they're getting involved in, and then they take it into probate court. They don't understand. They just went into the devil's den, okay? Because they're going to take every single penny. They're not going to stop until your mother is finally on just welfare and Medicare, Medicaid, whatever it is, and in the worst institutions you can be in, and they'll even stop you from seeing her. It just goes on and on and on. The evil there's only one court more evil than that court, and that's family court. Now, what I would do is you need to start thinking about how you're going to have to do this. You're not going to get a lawyer to be able to take care of your case. You're going to have to learn the law on your own and take it back, and you need to take it into federal court because this. I'd have to think about how you can couch this, but basically they don't have fiduciary authority. Who gave you fiduciary authority? The judge just took it on and said, well, I'm going to take the fiduciary authority when there's siblings there, their mother is in the case. You know, you got to think about this and create a case to take it into federal court for cause. Now, you got to work the cause out on what that cause would be, because that gets constitutional now. Okay?
Well, I mean, I have an appeal. I have an appeal. In the New Hampshire Supreme Court. Okay, so I'm in the process of representing myself / my mother, and so I'm writing my brief, and my appeal is based on a couple different things. One of it was that she was found incapacitated incorrectly based on the New Hampshire statute of guardianship.
You're making the wrong argument. That's not the argument. The argument is Zach's my mom. Like they're two other sisters. You need to get together with the other sisters. If they don't see what's going on by now, it's going to be a lost cause if you don't act together in one accord.
Oh, well, no, my sister is the guardian. My sister took my mother out of the home, put her in a facility, and is actually her and my brother are managing the money.
Is there a lawyer involved spending all the money? Who's spending all the money?
No, the lawyer's only involved to the extent that that lawyer is representing my sister and my brother, who now have guardianship, and
okay,
I mean,
can you work it out with them to work together or no?
Oh no, yeah, we're not even speaking, unfortunately.
Are you guys Christian?
Yeah, supposedly.
Well, you know, go get yourself a Christian counselor and let's talk about it, or talk, and you know, because if you're Christian, at least you can find a place where you can get some, you know, calmness, hopefully, and so on. But the thing is you need to work together as a family. It's unfortunate sometimes when you don't, you know?
Well, I mean, you know, I mean, the whole disagreement came really from the fact that, you know, they wanted to take my mom out of her home and put her in a facility, and I was against it. My mother didn't want to go, and I supported my mother in that. And they just were convinced that she needed to go into a home, and she's going to go into a home. So they got guardianship because they had a $55,000 lawyer.
So you were willing to take her into your home or what?
No, keep her in their own home.
Okay.
All right. Oh, she's paying over $11,000 a month where she is right now. I had her at home with professional 24/7 care for probably about $6,000 a month.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? That's what they wanted, was because they were so afraid that I was going to squander the money, even though I was paying half of what they were paying.
Let me ask you a question, though. Another question. Is she on Medicare, Medicaid?
No. I mean, she's got an estate. You know, her estate's worth just shy of $1 million.
No. Your mother, she's elderly. How old is she?
She's 87. She'll be 87 this year.
So she's getting Social Security. She's getting Medicare, Medicaid. They will give quite a bit of services in home, and between what the services they give and the family, definitely she could be living in her own home. I can't. You got to get to the heart of your siblings and work that out, because.
There's no working it out. She's in a facility, and I tried to actually get her into a facility that would just be back into her community. They took her an hour and a half away from her community, so she has no concept of connection. It's very sad. It's very sad. I don't know what's going on that they would be so cruel to her, but that's just the way it is. And so I'm in the midst of this. I'm going forward. There's no other options I have. At this point, I tried to communicate, let's do best, what's best for mom. And no, they're selling her house. So even though, you know, I've said to the court, listen, there's an appeal going on. You can't sell her house. You know, if the appeal is overturned by
the Supreme Court. You have a real difficult problem, and it's not like you can't go into the court. It's going to be very difficult. You can take it into state court and make an argument, and maybe you can win there. I'm not saying you don't, but it's a shame that they won't work it out with you, and I don't understand if someone could be living at home. I know if my parents were alive and they wanted to live at home, and that could be pulled off, I mean, it should be done, you know? So.
Yeah.
Were you people churchgoers or anything?
Not probably so much my brother.
If you were connected to a church or something, Not that I have a lot of faith in churches, but nevertheless, they're pretty good with counseling and different things and trying to bring family together and on issues, and that might be helpful. Because that's where I think is the best place to go if you can do that. But arguing it in state court, you might be able to do that. You might be able to build a case. But it's not something that you can go into federal court for cause. It's not where the court in itself has put an attorney in charge, and they're just sucking every dollar out of the system. You know, so it's
so, I guess what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to put together a brief, and I'm looking for maybe some resources. I've gone online, I've looked at things or whatever. It's just it's very overwhelming to put together a brief.
You have to understand how due process works, how the court system works, and the only way you're going to do that on your own is to take a course. We do give a course, but it's going to take a while to go through the course to be able to get to the point where you can write a brief. You know, some people can pick up on these things quicker than others, and, you know, it is possible, depending, you know, on your abilities, to do it very quickly. I mean, you know, I learned to do things very quickly, and but I put my full focus in on whatever I'm doing, you know, and until I understand every, you know, part of what I have to do. Again, you know, it depends on how you are on, you know, educating yourself.
Right. So what would you say would be a viable defense for my mom relative to looking at her civil rights, due process, her, you know, even though she was...
Well, you could start off with an affidavit that you know what the will of your mother was and what it is now, even though she... Look, there are times when they have lucid moments, okay?
And my mother's not that far gone.
Well, if she's had lucid moments, right there, get her to do an affidavit with you, get witnesses. If she's in an institution, well, it depends on the institution, too, you know, whether they'll work with you on that, because maybe they got their claws in it and don't want to let it go either. But I don't know how that all works or what's involved there.
She pays them almost $12,000, you know, a month. I'm sure they don't want to let her go. What you're saying is I can produce an affidavit by going in and...
You can do an affidavit, number one, that you know what the will of your mother is, the desire of your mother, you know if she's depressed or not, you know, so on and so forth. You could talk about the cost factors and how you could do it cheaper. You can put this whole thing together and make... And also you had, even though there was a battle on it, nevertheless, you had the power of attorney at one point. Then you get your mother at the same time to sit down and have a conversation with her. You want to get a witness or two with that conversation. And, if you can get a counselor of some kind, or you've got to get a couple of witnesses, okay? And you have to have the conversation, and everybody writes the affidavit that, yes, she's lucid. This is a desire. It's clear. Yes, she's got problems. She's got memory problems, but she can still make decisions. She could still live on her own. And this is a desire. So, you know, you write down what she says, and then you give it to her and go through it, make sure that's her true will. You know, this is what she wants. So that becomes an affidavit. And then the people who participated with you write their affidavits on how this whole thing was put together, and you build a case off that.
Okay. All right. I mean, the problem is that, you know, because she's been deemed incapacitated, that you know, it's just like they don't care anymore what she wants. It's all best interest.
Right.
In the garden.
I understand that, but you're challenging that, okay? And then, you know, how would she stand up in court as a witness for herself? How would that be able to go well?
She wouldn't be able to do that just because, you know, she's afraid. She'd be afraid to do it.
Make sure you have a camera going when you have the conversation with her and going through those processes.
I can't do that. I already videotaped her when I felt like she was being abused and she was describing it to me. And then when I went to court, they told me that I had just committed a Class B felony.
What for?
Because even though I got her permission to videotape her, because she's incapacitated, she doesn't have the ability to give her permission.
The proof of everything is in the video. Well, was the proof?
It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
Well, I know. They play their games. I understand. Again, they got their claws. They don't want to let the claws out. There's money in it for them.
Yeah. I mean, that's what the judge told me when I stood. And I said, listen, you've got to see that this woman is describing abuse. And they said, no, you just committed a Class B felony. I said, well, what difference? Don't you want to see that this woman is describing being abused? No, you've committed a Class B felony, and you've admitted it in court.
Well, we can't go too much further because we're 48 minutes beyond our shutdown.
Okay,
here's my advice to you, okay? Do what I told you to do. I do the recording anyway. I talked with a lawyer about this before, because, you know, look, at whether you use it in court or not, it's good to have the video, okay? And you may be able to use it in court, and you use it in court. First of all, they have no business to even say this. There's nothing wrong. Look, if they use cameras on you, they'll interview you and use cameras on you, and it doesn't matter whether, you know, and I see a lot of stupid people that get interviewed, and they say stupid things, and they just destroy their own selves, you know, and if they use those videos. But if your mother is still elusive, it doesn't matter that the court says she no longer has her wits about her. That doesn't matter if you can show that she does have enough of it to be able to make that decision. She's not happy. That's the point you need to make and make your battle. And then I would say educate yourself. Take the course, Court Access in the Common Law. It's, you know, it's only $125, and you're going to get a real education in it. Everyone should do it because no one should be in a situation where they get stuck in a court. And now, I can't tell you how many people come to us and talk to us, and they have no knowledge of the law, and they're stuck in a court. And now you've got to educate yourself, and there's not enough time to educate. Well, people should start right away. You should be prepared for this. As a matter of fact, we're going to be pushing to get this education as a normal education in school, in high school. Children should be able to take this course and be able to take care of their own legal situations, you know?
Right. Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for taking my call. I appreciate it. And that you've given me some good advice and some things to kind of move forward with. I appreciate that.
Okay. Get the video anyway. You can decide on whether to use them anyway at another time. Talk to a lawyer because they know the civil law better than I do, of course. I don't participate with civil law, but, you know, I'll use it against them as best I can, which is pretty easy to do, really. But the thing is that you'll get another opinion. I can't believe the judge said that. You committed a felony. That's ridiculous. And you're the family, you know, no less.
Yeah. No. Well, and I was trying to actually show abuse, and I it's just like, well, if I walked in and I saw my mother being raped by one of the aides, and I videotaped it, would you not want to see that? That's like,
what's wrong with this? This judge is what? Well, you're looking at a probate judge, you know, to begin with. So, again, you know, they make these decisions, and it's a shame that the family brought that in there.
Well, they got to have a doctor's opinion on that. It's not, the judge don't have the authority to say she's.
That is the other thing. You go see a doctor.
They usually have two doctors to say that she's incompetent.
Well, you know what? You know what? The whole case depended on the fact that she, they gave her one of those Montreal cognitive assessment tests, and she rated really low on it. I was with her when she took it, you know. And I thought, well, she did okay, but not great, you know. But it had nothing to do with her capacity. And those tests are not meant to evaluate capabilities.
They got doctors in the hospital that are experts on that.
Yeah.
And all she got to know is who's, you know, like just stupid questions like who's the president, what day is it, that type of stuff.
Yeah, but even more than that, just the conversation in itself and what she wants and what she doesn't want and how that conversation goes over the course of a half hour or 45 minutes or whatever it might be.
Yeah, so get somebody
to establish.
Get somebody to question her and videotape it.
Yeah, it should be a medical doctor. That's a good idea.
Right. No, it should be, yeah.
Yeah, and you'd want to talk with that doctor, you know, about being there at the time, and maybe you know other people. You got to have the witness. Well, the doctor's credentials should be enough.
Look, they have to make these decisions every day. They bring old people in. They're going to give them a shot or something. They have to know that they're competent to say yes or no. And if they don't think they are, then they need to get somebody else in the family in there.
I'm a payee for somebody. They're in their 60s. They're losing their mind in the sense to, you know, going through this whole process, okay? And they've got a lot of medical problems, and he wants nothing to do with an institution. And and his memory is really bad, but he's still functioning. He's still, you can have conversations, sometimes very lucid. He forgets, he'll have a conversation, and then, 10 minutes later, he forgot that he had that conversation. But the other thing is that their memories going back years ago, they seem to retain a lot of that,
They lose short-term memory, right?
Yeah. Short-term stuff. But once you can prove the fact that they can take care of themselves, especially with help at home,
She was doing great at home, and then once they took her out, she lost perspective.
Well, she's in depression, I bet. I bet that's the other thing you want to get the doctor to see if she's depressed. And
she just wants to go home, And then she broke her hip there. She fell and broke her hip at the facility, and so she was in the hospital, and then when they put her in the hospital, she became actually very lucid. She was like, oh, gosh, she thought she was going home, But she became very lucid. She understood.
I don't understand. Your sister I don't understand why your sister would be so resistant to this.
They don't want to take care of my mother.
You got the whole process set up, and you're helping her?
I had it all set up. Everything was great. She's doing great at home. But no, she just had personal issues with me over the years, and it was just a way to get the last dig in that she's going to do what she wants to do, and it's going to be the opposite of what I want to do. I have nothing to do with what's best for my mother, and it's very sad. It's very sad. I'm sorry to have to say that. It's just very, very sad.
All right, well, I hate to say it, but we've got to move on because it's really late. One of the persons.
Yeah, thanks again. Again. I appreciate your help. Okay. All right.
Bye-bye.
Okay, Ricardo.
Yes, sir, from Fargo, North Dakota.
Oh, no kidding. Okay.
And
I remember that movie.
The whole thing was filmed in Brainerd, Minnesota. Had nothing
right.
to do with North Dakota. I knew one of the people who were doing the movie, one of the producers.
I'm no kidding.
That was just they used Fargo because it just sounded better than Brainerd, Minnesota.
Right.
But all the stuff you're there was I know the lakes where they did all that stuff. We don't have lakes like that in North Dakota.
Right.
They don't call Minnesota the land of 10,000 lakes for nothing, right?
Right.
It's actually over 14,000. 10,000 is your number to remember. Okay, my question is this. I have to do is we hear about this contract law and stuff, and is it that UCC connection? Are you guys familiar with that book that you have? I bought that one, and they're talking in there about how to free yourself from legal tyranny. I don't know if any of that stuff is relevant.
Look, that's the UCC, and you got to be real careful with it because that's their rules you're playing with.
Yeah,
and they can turn it on you so quick.
Okay.
I used to follow a guy that did it all over the place, him and his wife, and they used a lot of UCC-1 stuff, and he was always in jail, but he always sued and won, but it was like they were always getting arrested, and then they were suing. They live separate lives together in jail, this husband and wife, and they sued all the sheriffs and all the counties, and they were really good at it, but they never could keep themselves out of jail for some reason.
Okay.
It's crazy.
Well, he's going in there saying some things. He's had 100% success as of the writing of the book, and he's writing from this guy by Mr. Freeman.
Yeah.
He's the one who wrote the book. Okay. Anyway, they were talking about signing documents and contracts under UCC 1-308. I met a truck driver guy. He does that on his driver's license. Under duress, preserving your rights.
Well, if
other guys,
try to do that in New York State, they won't accept it. They know about.
Yeah, well, we're in North Dakota, so. But I'm just wondering, is a lease the same as any other kind of contract form? I'm just asking a question when you have a contract, and what I was taught in my law classes in college 50 years ago in little town of Valley City, North Dakota, it was not a university. We had a local lawyer that was teaching a class, and he was saying a contract is agreement between two parties to perform. If either party doesn't do their part, the contract is null and void. Don't know if that's still true or not, but I'm seeing some things in there regarding the Constitution, any statutes, laws, anything repugnant or null and void as if it never existed. All right, so I want to get down to the lease thing. Can a lease take away your rights? your First Amendment, Second Amendment rights.
No.
And I'm in a situation. She's a freak. She's a control freak.
Listen. When it comes to anything with your unalienable rights, they cannot be sold or exchanged.
Okay.
You can either exercise it or not. That's your choice. But other than that, you can't lose it. Look, I've been in lots.
Now, what I did is I signed the lease. I signed the lease the last time around, UCC 1-308. I kind of put her on notice. I'm preserving my rights. She would say things to me. She was breaking her lease all the time. Her responsibilities, she was constantly violating them. But she thinks she could do whatever she wants, and I have no recourse. Well, you signed the lease. And I said, well, so did you. You have some responsibilities to do, and the lease says this, and you're doing something else. And you don't think nothing up. You've lied. You misrepresented. You used threats. So what I'm trying to get at is, can I use that 1-3-3-0-8? I did sign a lease.
Yeah, you don't even need that. You don't even need that. The bottom line, it is a contract. You, like you said, you have something to do, they have something to do. You know, as a contractor, I've written hundreds of contracts, maybe 1,000. I don't, lots of contracts.
Okay.
And not only for myself, but for others. And contracts, generally, you know, especially as a general contractor, you know, your job is to produce and create. Their job is to pay. And there's a process. Once they break that process, they break the agreement. Now you can, you know, arbitrate it and move on, and you know, depending on what it is. But sometimes it's so bad that it's just you just want to. They broke it. That's it. You sue, and it's over.
Well, so what she's threatening to do is say, well, the first time around, I've been here for 4 years and been fighting around and around rather, and I thought, well, I'm just going to go along but just document everything that I got, all my stuff. And but she's just non-negotiable. And what we're down to now is that she says I can only have two. She got it. She changed the lease the last time around. You can only have two cars in your driveway. And it's four townhomes connected, and then across the driveway area, there's another four more townhomes. There's all these driveways. And he said, well, you can put two cars in your garage and two in the driveway, and you can't have any more in there. Well, I have two small cars. I can put three cars in my boundary of my double garage thing. And she's threatening, well, you're affecting your lease. She's using subtle threats, and I understand that. She can't do that. But would there be some value in, could you give me some advice, what I can do to kind of advise her? What she's doing is really illegal, and she's not.
Well, the problem is, did you agree to two cars?
No, I put under. I'm contesting it. I put under duress. There was no negotiating it. I said I have room for three cars.
Well, you're going to have other problems because, you know, they can get you out under other terms also if that's what they're trying to do. So you got to be careful, especially if you don't want to move. But, you know, again, it gets to the meeting of the minds. If people aren't negotiating, well, then you probably shouldn't assign the lease, you know. So that's the argument to be made from the other side, the other lawyer, and, you know, it's hard to respond against that.
So that goes back to my question.
Just putting, you know, that on your contract in signature, you're making a contract, okay? And if you're agreeing or not agreeing, you know, and if you're not going to agree, then you make the changes. And if you don't make the changes and you refuse to make the changes, then you can't get a contract, you know?
Okay.
Now, how long you been there? How many leases have you had? Four leases, and how often is a lease done? Every year, 2 years, what?
Yearly.
Okay, and then they added it in on the last lease.
Yeah, about that. Well, the first issue was all utilities are being our name. You know, the garbage, the sewer and water, the utilities, the electricity, the gas, you know, for heat. There's four different entities. And my wife was standing right there when the first time we got in, she said, I'll take care of putting the lease in your name. And so she misrepresented, and I'll tell you why. Okay, so I kept the first couple of months. I said, hey, I haven't gotten a – you said you took care of putting the lease in my name. I haven't gotten a statement. Well, you have your statement in your property account. And I thought, well, she's a property manager. She's not even the owner of the property. And I said, well, I need to know how much my water consumption is because in my lease it says I'm responsible to get everything put in my name. You said you were going to take care of that one and didn't tell me what was going on. And I said, I've been asking for an accounting, a billing. You've never given it to me. And I signed on to the presumption you're going to do this. Well, then she threatened to. So I did my own measurement. I found out from the maintenance guy there's only 1 meter for these four units. 1 meter. Ah, okay. But she said she was going to put it in my name. All right, so there she lied the first time. So my point being is when they break their lease, when they lie and all this kind of stuff, do
well,
I
that's against the law. You can't have four different dwellings with one, and so you got four families and working off of 1 meter. Is that what's going on? That's unlawful. That's unlawful. It's against the law.
After the second year,
That is enough that she needs to correct.
Here's what she did. Here's what she did. She didn't change the verbiage about all the children have to be in our name before we even get the key. Well, I got the key because she's going to take care of it. All right. So now we get down to this part. Well, the lease, she said, you signed the lease. I said, and so did you. You agreed to do this, and now you're going to threaten to have me evicted for not paying. The lease
right.
is not part of my rent.
Let me just say this, you know, because it is really late. It's goodness, it's after midnight now. But here's the thing, okay? If you can make a case on these things, then and it's logical, and you can bring it into court, you could win, okay? But you also got to watch out that this person may just want to get rid of you too, and they can get rid of you on other issues or deny a lease or whatever, because they own the property. So you got to be careful.
Yeah, and they can do that. They can do that.
So the thing is this: if the big thing is two cars maximum, and you agreed to that, if that's one of the main things, and the other thing, there is an electric problem because you're paying for other people's electric, you know? Well, who's paying for the other three? Are they trying to piecemeal it somehow or break it up?
Well,
she
added some verbiage in when I caught her on the part about that we talked about. She added another sentence and didn't take the thing off the box. She just said, there's only 1 meter. We're going to apportion it.
Okay, look, common law is common sense. So if you can make a good common law argument, even in a small, you know, court, you can deal with the problems and potentially win the case on logic, but not the judges have logic. So
well, can I get into this thing about where what I wanted to get at is under statutory law they cannot control my behavior.
But I don't understand. Your case would really, you'd have to evaluate every part of every problem, every situation, and sit down and see if you can't put a case together that could win. But you can cause other problems, too, because bad...
Yeah, I'm just getting into generally speaking, just to get to understand how this stuff all works. Okay.
I would, you got a lease, you got whatever's on that lease, you got to live to, but the electric is a problem, you should talk with... Let me ask you a question. There's four families on 1 meter. Is that what you're telling me?
Yes, four units.
Okay. Yeah. So who are the other three? Who's paying electric on the other three? Are you paying one quarter?
I'm paying one fourth, yes.
Okay. Well, that's against the law, too, because you can make the claim. You know, especially with today, the way the economy is and trying to save a dollar everywhere you can, and you may not leave lights on here or there or keep the heat down low there or whatever the case may be. It just doesn't work. That's just, you can't do that. So four people, you're paying one quarter, but it's in your name being paid?
No. It's in the property management's name.
Okay.
That's her bill.
Okay, again, you can make a case in court, but, again, who knows where it's going to go with a judge. An arbitrator may be better. But I don't know.
Okay.
If she's got the bill in her name, she's done.
Bill in her name. She told
she's
me
done. She owes that bill. She can't split it up. She has no authority to split it. That means she's paying for everybody's electricity. And she can't
come
around.
Well, at least it says that we're responsible for each our own. And she told me she was going to put it in our name. It was a year later.
Well, look, the only way that they can keep it in the name is to say, well, okay, electric is included in the rent, and then she would have her number.
Yes.
And then every year, if the bill is going up, she might want to raise the rent because, of course, they've gone up. And
yes.
That's the legal way.
I've
so
got
that,
a friend that owned multiple properties, and that's what I asked him about that. I said, well, you can't. You shouldn't have to be expected to pay for somebody else's water usage. And he said, I can't do that, he goes. And so he just says what he does, he just takes an average, but if somebody starts to abuse it and get more and more water, well, here's the problem. I haven't stated this part of it. the city, I called the city department to come over, and I got a copy of all their, there's five of these fourplex units in here, in this block. And I went to the city utilities and got a copy of the bills for every one of those. Because I went down there, I'm going to put it in my name. She said, well, you can't, there's only 1 meter. That's how I found out there was only 1 meter. And I told them what she was doing, and they said, she can't do that. But she just wasn't whatever she wants, but I didn't know what to do. So anyway, I went back to this whole thing, got the average of all of theirs. And nobody, I was a homeowner, and I had a garden, I had a yard, and I was watering all this stuff, and, you know, I had teenage kids and stuff, and I've kept track of my stuff. I never used more than 2,500 gallons of water a month. That's even watering gardens and all the stuff I was doing. My mail lady, who has a different, just a house, she has four teenagers, because I asked her, what is your water bill? So I just went around and asked around, and I asked different people, the most water that it ever used. The average one, this gal I'm going to tell you about was exceptional, but most of them, the most they ever used, and I said, well, how long do you take a shower? I like long showers. Well, it tells you right on the faucet how much water is going through that faucet in a shower, 2.5 gallons a minute. And so if you take a 20-minute shower,
listen,
you take
sounds,
a minute.
It sounds like you've done
lady,
enough homework.
Let me finish. That lady said her poor family, they took a shower every day. They washed loads of clothes every day. She kept crying, well, you got a leaky toilet. I said, I don't have no leaky toilet. Nobody else got a leaky toilet. Why are her water bills so high? I was trying to get her to admit to something, but she wouldn't. So what it turned out, we're being billed for 50, let's say, what is it? It's $7 per thousand for sewer and water, right? And so I got the bill for it, and I did the average on it. The average we were paying was 12,000 to 14,000 gallons a month for water. Had the city utility guys come over, and he did a check, and I said, well, you got a broken water main. We're in Unit C, and Unit A has the meter. He said, it's something after the meter. If it was before it, the city would be responsible. But you got a broken main line somewhere after Unit A's where the meter is. And that's what she was trying to hide. So I went to the owner of the property. I said, listen, we got a major problem going on here. I shouldn't have to pay for everybody else's water. And it's her name, and she should be paying for it. Why didn't you just put it into the rent? Well, I got her on the thing about, well, I'm late. I would pay what I used, because that's what my lease says. I'm responsible for my units, not for the whole thing. Well, then she added this little verbiage on the last time around on the fourth lease, though it's apportioned. But still, it's like... And then when the units are empty,
let me just ask one question, and we have to, you know, because we're over an hour long, but. But let me ask you one question. Does she give you a copy of the bill every month, comes in, and then you pay a quarter of it?
No.
Well, you don't know what the actual bill is. She tells you what the bill is?
Yes. I know what it is.
All you got to do is go to the electric company and tell them what's going on, and they will come in and smooth it out.
They tell me how much water is being.
Well, they'll come in and force her to put 4 meters there.
She has to pay for it all.
Last year in the city of West Fargo, where I live, they put all new electronic meters. You can know by the minute how much water you're using, and if there's a lot of water running. So what I was going to do, you can buy these. You don't have to actually cut the line. You just tap, and it can tell you how much water each one. If you shut the water off, it shuts them. No, each unit has its own shutoff. And the water line coming into the four units is 1.5 inches. Well, the meters that they put in all the residential is a 5/8 inch line. And so I went and looked at the ours, looked at all the other ones. All of them, they all have 5-inch line. So I thought, well, I'm just going to kind of see where we're going to go with this thing. But we're going to move out anyway in a couple months. But I just, for the other residents, they're constantly complaining about these ridiculously high water bills.
You may be guilty of fraud. And, you might be able to settle. Because
the thing is
once you do the investigation and then you find out that she is guilty of fraud, then you lay it out to her and say, now what are we going to do about it? Then you can work things out, hopefully, and not even go to court But you got to know that you're going to be on your way out at that point, because he's going
to. Now, when I get the sheriff involved,
but with that, I really got to go.
Last question. This is totally unrelated. You were talking about mortgage companies and that. We're looking to buy a house. Which is better to go through, a credit union? North Dakota has its own bank. The only state in the union that has its own bank, Bank of North Dakota. All right, and then a credit union, a local bank, or one of these independent mortgage thing kind of companies. Do you have an opinion on it?
No, not really. I mean, yeah, I don't have.
I would say that a credit union is a good alternative.
As far as banking is concerned, absolutely a credit union. But if you're going to go to a credit union, they're going to go to the Fed window for money. They're not going to give you money out of their own.
But they still don't have all the rules that the other banks have. They're a private organization.
Well, that's for banking. I absolutely agree. But the thing I'm trying to say is, if he goes to a place that actually puts the money up somewhere, which is rare, I would believe, because all these banks, they go to the Fed window. They don't put their own money up. They get the point, and they make money by settling the loan. They're not making money on the interest of the loan, because that goes to the Fed window for that. Again, that's a whole different process and a whole different education that you need to do to understand that.
Yep.
And it's not a lot, but we wrote a paper on that for non-judicial foreclosures particularly, which deals with the fact that it's the Fed window. And nobody's, you know, there's no skin in the game from the bank. The bank has already been paid off.
That's from that book, The Meet Your Straw Man. Is that valid resource to look at? As far as getting out of these mortgages,
someone stole my handbook, and maybe they added other stuff in or put certain words in, because we don't get into the straw man. We've talked about the straw man, of course. We have a video on the straw man. It of course is true, but we don't use that in legal processes. Nor do we have a handbook that deals with that. We deal with the common law. And the truth of the fact
on the back of the cover, it says nationallibertyalliance.org.
Yeah, because someone has taken our information, is making money off of it. I tried to stop that, but I can't even get a hold of it. I can't find the person who did it, but they are getting paid through Amazon. Amazon won't talk to me, and I got to go to court in order to deal with it.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't have the time for that, because I got other things.
Just this question. He makes a statement. Every mortgage and loan is fully repaid from day one. You can pay it again if you want to, but you don't have to. True or false?
Say this again.
He said, every mortgage and loan is fully repaid from day one. You can pay it again if you want to, but you don't have to.
Right,
if nobody told you that you have a straw man, then this could be a very interesting experience for you. All right, I'll just leave it at that.
Well, that is true, but fighting it in court, you're not going to win from that perspective.
Because it's non-judicial foreclosure, which you mentioned earlier, there's a note in there having it can stay.
Right.
And keep denying and eventually you can own the house after about 5 years. Anyway, okay, I just wanted to know what I could do. What I'm planning to do is I got all this stuff documented. When I get down to my last month's lease payment, I'm going to withhold all that money that she overcharged me for. And I just want to know what would be the best way to do that, make her take me to court.
Once you prove fraud on paper and give her the information, without threatening her or even defining that it's fraud, but the fact that you can get information, how much money was being actually on the bills, how much money you've been actually paying, and you can lay that out, that's a slam dunk if you did go to court. She wouldn't go to court with you.
Just be careful. Make sure you take that money and put it in an escrow account, because that could get you in trouble if you don't.
All right.
Hey, John, do we have a place where we can show, like, links on this start meeting or no? I got a really good article from Nikki, Nick, on consideration and what makes a contract.
Well, you can share the desktop and put it on your browser.
I put it in your Skype box. You should. It's too late tonight, but.
I need to go to bed. I think
maybe next week we should bring this up, because a couple questions came up that this here would explain some of that stuff. You know, I mean, it's very well done, this article.
That's what I was looking for.
We'll talk about that maybe tomorrow, and like you say, maybe we'll bring it up next week and talk
more. I'd like to get into more detail, because what I should do, but I like what you said about the fraud thing. I can do that. I can prove that it was fraud. I even got witnesses to the whole thing. She's done so many things that are just plain wrong. But I wanted to wait until I'm going to move out on my last month's rent. We have to give her 2 months' notice, and the last month's rent, I'm just going to hold it off. And if I'm going to serve her, I'm going to give her a written notice why I'm doing it. Right? Is that what you're saying to do?
Well, yeah, at that point, and then give her a bill. You give her a proof of claim. You know, just write up a bill. and say, hey, look,
how I figured. I went to the Century Code, North Dakota Century Code about this. They said if they're doing something they're not supposed to do, they're not fixing things properly, you can itemize it and subtract it off your rent and then move out.
Absolutely. Yeah, you give it a bill. Now she'd have to chase you in court. She wouldn't win.
Well, the Century Code says you can deduct it right off of your rent.
Yeah, the point is she's not going to sue you because she's going to lose, and it's going to cost more money to try to recoup the money, and it's not just not worth it.
And what they'll do is they'll try to put it on a credit report, you know, whatever. And
okay, but with that, I got to go.
Okay, we're going to go. All right, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you next week. Thank you for standing
up. All right, good night, everybody.
As always, good help.
Okay, good night. Good night, everybody.
Good night.
It's Monday, everybody. Good night.
Bye-bye.